This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Lu Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
It's the original Jingle Meisters of Place to Be Nation Pop. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me here in luxurious, bounteous Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in the Hard Traveling Studios in Ho-Ho-Lu Plaza, my good friend, my compatriot, and a real American hero, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you, good sir?
I'm doing very well, sir. And just to show you how I truly feel about you, Greg, I am going to buy you tall, tall trees and all the waters in the seas because I'm a fool for you.
Well, I will tell you this. All of that stuff sounds good, but I'm crazy about a Mercury. And I think I'm going to take my earnings from this week's show and I'm going to buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road.
Now, see, is a Mercury really the wisest automobile purchase? Because you got to remember, Greg, there's something women like about a pickup, man.
You're mixing your metaphors here, my friend. You're switching into Diffie-isms.
Listen.
Because I would argue that I can't even afford a pickup right now, because if the devil danced in empty pockets, he'd have a ball in mine.
You'd have a ball in yours, yes, that's true.
With a 9-foot gland, as I always heard it. Anyway,
we need to do the all 80s and 90s country edition of Easy Like David Sunday, where you and I just take over David's show and he just sits there and sighs the entire time.
Yeah. Yes. 80s and 90s country for life.
Yes.
I thought you were going to suggest that we create an 80s and 90s country all American team and then put them against each other in a hypothetical fantasy matchup.
In what sport, though? Like, because that would,
I don't know.
That would determine a lot, because if it's football and you got to fill out a full 11, or even a full 22, or a full 25, if you're talking specialists, that's a different ball game as opposed to something like basketball, where it's a 5-on-5 affair. But then again, they are country artists, so basketball will be out the window.
Right. Maybe golf.
Dolph, yes, yes.
It's too hot to fish. It's too hot for golf. And it's too cold at home.
It's too cold at home.
So, anyway, we are here to bring you off the page, and apparently way off the page.
Yes.
This is where we take a look at a piece of comic book media that is not a comic book itself.
Indeed.
And this could be anything from a video game to
a board game to
backgammon. But mostly it's movies and TV shows.
Right.
And what we're doing here today is we are offering a review of I'm not even sure why we picked it for this month, but Spider-Man 2 by Sam Raimi.
I can answer that question, Greg, if you'd like for me to. The idea was, I don't know if you remember last year, we did a month of stuff we hated in January and then a month of stuff we loved in February. We were going to do the same thing this year, but we had Black Panther month in February, so I moved our month of stuff we love back, which is why this month it's all just talking about things that we just don't really have many bad things to say about.
Does that mean that this is the return of the heart-traveling fanboys?
I suppose I shouldn't have told you that, but I guess technically yes.
It's my favorite time of the year other than the happies.
Heart-traveling
fanboys.
That makes no sense.
We're here to tell you about a project that we love. Mm-hmm. We love this movie, Spider-Man 2 by Sam Raimi, mm-hmm. and starring a cavalcade of stars from the early 2000s. And
a
some
veritable heaven of stars from the early 2000s.
That's right. And some who would become strong-style stars later on. Now, We've got just a
including Kirsten Dunst, who wound up actually becoming Tomohiro Ishii, strangely enough.
Good lord, man.
I'm rather proud of that one. Actually, I'm gonna do an old thing, Greg. I'm gonna say,
Let me tell you, I have never seen Tomohiro Ishii's headlights shining like.
Listen, this was 14 years ago. So you know, she had a lot of work done in the time since then.
Nipple reduction surgery.
Actually, given her paleness in this movie, perhaps Minoru Suzuki would have been a better pull. But I'm going to stand by. I'm going to stand by my stone pit bull.
Minoru Suzuki would be an awesome like lizard, but you wouldn't even have to change anything about him. You wouldn't have to use any effects.
Minoru Suzuki. Whenever they do the Gus Van Sant shot for shot remake of the Amazing Spider-Man 2, he should play the Green Goblin in it.
Yes. Perfect. But yes, we are here to talk to you about a very serious subject, drugs.
Yeah, you can tell it's going to be a very serious podcast tonight.
But one of those drugs is the Green Goblin Enhancement Formula, which is featured very briefly in Spider-Man 2, the movie we're here to talk to you about today. Mm-hmm. Now, we have reviewed on this very podcast and in our columns, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Nick, two Spider-Man movies. We reviewed Spider-Man Homecoming last year, and I believe in our column we may have, or in an earlier podcast, we may have briefly given our summation of The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which we are planning on actually doing an in-depth review of at some point in the future.
I can't wait for that. That has become, Greg, already just... Greg and I had a very brief offline conversation about that movie today, and it is rapidly shooting up my list of most anticipated podcasts. Like, doing it off the page on that movie is going to be so much fun. Because people, just in brief to lead with this, people dump all over Spider-Man 3, and I think people don't realize just how bad The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is. It is a Ghost Rider level atrocity on the part of Sony Pictures, in my opinion.
It is not only significantly... exceedingly worse than Spider-Man 3. It may be significantly worse than any comic book film that has followed it.
Since then?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm struggling to think of one. I have not seen the Josh Trank Fantastic Four. That's probably the only one
either.
That would immediately come
either.
To mind in terms of how it's received.
To show you a comparison, I think Suicide Squad is better than The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
That's a good comparison, you know?
Yeah, like but Suicide Squad has at least entertaining performances in it.
And I would argue that Amazing Spider-Man 2 does have at least one of those, but we are veering wildly off topic.
That's another subject for another time. It will come at some point. But we've reviewed several Spider-Man projects, and this is kind of, I guess, the white whale in the situation of the most prominent Spider-Man related movie that there's been, and we haven't really ever touched on it that much. We've mentioned it a few times in some of our favorite fight scenes, for instance, or favorite superhero movies, things like that, but we've never really delved into it a lot in one of these, and so we figured what better time than to look at what is considered by critics to be the best Spider-Man movie, and one that has stood the test of time as kind of a pretty groundbreaking film in its day, too. This was, X2 got really good reviews, but not, amazingly, not blowaway reviews like you would expect. And so I think that this movie was probably the best reviewed superhero movie since Christopher Reeve's Superman. Because even Tim Burton's Batman didn't get...
Yeah, it had some divisive nature about it.
Detractors, right.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't remember how Superman 2 was received, you know, because obviously I wasn't alive and... Rotten Tomatoes wasn't a thing back then.
Right.
So, yeah.
Back then, they were just regular tomatoes that hadn't yet gone rotten.
Attack of
the Killer Tomatoes. Remember that? They made a cartoon out of it, too.
They did. I think they did a remake, actually. No, they remade straight-to-DVD Killer Clowns from Outer Space, not Attack of the Rotten Tomatoes. My mistake.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, you mean.
Killer Tomatoes, Rotten Tomatoes, who gives a shit?
The Anyway, so...
9 minutes in, and we have had barely any talk of Spider-Man 2 thus far.
Right.
Just telling you what this
is
going to be.
It's a great challenge of when you review something that's very good.
Yeah. I mean,
and not particularly divisive in any way. So, this came on the heels 2 years later. This came out in 2004, right, Nick?
Yes, that is correct. Because Spider-Man, the first one, Sam Raimi Spider-Man, remember, was slated for a December 2001 release date and memorably featured a key sequence set in the World Trade Center. So in the wake of 9/11, they wound up delaying that movie to May and arguably kind of kicking off the now what it seems like a comic book tradition of having early May big time superhero
release dates. I don't remember when X-Men came out. I feel like it was somewhere around like, I don't know. Was it a summer release? Was it? I don't even remember.
Greg, not to get your penis too hard on this, but just to, one more aside, Ricochet will be competing in a 6-man ladder match at NXT TakeOver New Orleans.
That sounds fair.
just wanted to clue you in on that Ricochet will be diving off ladders on your television soon.
Not to tell tales out of skewel, but there may be a certain 60-second long segment later in the show,
I'm sorry. My apologies. How dare we exceed our self-imposed 60-second mandate?
That's right. But that does excite me and intrigue me. Much like the waters of the whatever the hell body of water that is excite Kirsten Dunst's body in certain scenes.
What the hell are you talking about?
Go back and watch that sequence at the end.
I just watched the movie. Anyway, we should probably get around to the movie.
Premise is that this came on the heels just two years later of Spider-Man 1, the first Spider-Man film by Sam Raimi. And that was a monster hit. Even beyond what X-Men had been before it.
It was the first, like, X-Men made a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. X-Men was obviously wildly financially successful. But I would argue that, you know, since the Batman, the heyday of the Batman franchise back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, this was the first bona fide superhero blockbuster in, you know, what would that be, Greg? 10 years at that point from 92 to 02, because you got to remember Batman Returns and Batman Forever also both made a lot of money. So it had been a little while. So if you go from Batman Forever, which was 95, it had been seven years since the genre had really hit it big at the box office. And I think this one hit it big in a way that nobody really saw coming. I mean, I remember I was extremely excited for the first Spider-Man movie. I was pumped for it. I thought it looked awesome. I had always been a fan of the character, as you know, and like, I was pumped, but even I didn't see, like, I'll give you an example, Greg. There are very few times I've ever gone to see a movie in food capital of the world, Dothan, Alabama, and the screening's actually been sold out. But I remember that opening weekend, you could not get in the theater on Friday or Saturday, pretty much all day. I wound up having to go to like a Sunday matinee just to be able to see it opening weekend, because that was back in the day when there was no like advanced sales. You had to show up to the theater to buy your tickets and whatnot.
We stood in line. I was in high school, my senior year of high school, when Spider-Man 1 came out, and we stood in line at outside the theater by our house in Mobile, Alabama, and we stood out there in a line, I would say, for probably an hour and a half waiting to get into the theater to buy tickets to see this movie, the first one, I mean, and we were pumped for it, but I don't think I expected culture to be as pumped.
Yeah, the casual buzz that there was. And so
it very much felt like the kind of zeitgeist that we would see years later with the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right.
Except at that point it felt like this was going to kick down the walls
and give us superhero
movies on a major level.
Right. You probably remember it because you're older than I am, but like I wasn't really old enough to remember, you know, the hype going into the Tim Burton 89 Batman movie. But like,
I mean, I was five, so
right?
I barely remember it.
But from people I've talked to and from what I've read online, this one felt like the first one in my lifetime that kind of had that around it.
X-Men was like, people were excited for X-Men, but it was mostly people that knew who the X-Men were and stuff like that.
Or watched the cartoon or something like that, yeah.
And it was very important, a very important movie, but Spider-Man felt like just, I remember the trailers for it looked so amazing. Yes. Like, oh my God, we're seeing what we never thought we'd see before on the big screen, technology we'd never thought we'd see on the big screen. So it was exciting from the get go. And like you said, it did feel like whatever, you know, Batmania in 89. Right. I was really too young. I mean, all I remember in 89 is wanting the Happy Meal that had the toy with it. So,
right, right. And so, I mean, what happens here is, like you said, Spider-Man hits massive at the box office. I believe it actually set an opening weekend record at the time. I'd have to look that up, but I'm too lazy to do it right now if that's actually the case. But, and you know, the first Spider-Man movie, you can kind of, you know, retroactively decide, you know, for yourself whether or not it holds up or not. I still like the movie a lot. I think I'm actually higher on it than you are probably.
Yeah, but at the time,
it was
mind blowing.
Right.
No one can deny that.
Right.
The first time you see that movie in the theater, it's hard to replicate that.
Right, and it was, you know, critically beloved. It made a ton of money, and so instantly, you know, talk turned to a sequel, and the expectations for this movie, you know, there was more excitement, I think, for Spider-Man 1, but I think there were higher expectations for Spider-Man 2 coming in. And as you know, expectation is always a difficult thing because expectation can ruin an otherwise decent movie if it doesn't meet them, you know, and it was very concerning coming in, you know.
And if you just play the numbers, we had just come off in 2003 a superhero sequel that exceeded the original in X-Men 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so playing the numbers, you can't figure that was going to happen again, because at that time, the common knowledge among any kind of movie fans were that the sequel's never as good as the original,
mm-hmm.
With very few exceptions. So it was, at least that was the common knowledge, whether it was true or not, that was what people thought. So into Spider-Man 2, you're thinking, man, that the hype is so huge for this. All of us were super pumped for it, and I wasn't nearly as cynical then as I've become in my old age. I don't think culturally we were quite there with cynicism yet as we are nowadays.
Right.
So I think people were genuinely excited to see what was going to happen next. But again, I don't think many of us were expecting it to be better than the first. We just wanted it to be as good as the first.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where there are certain franchises where, you know, you don't want every sequel to be the same thing, but there are certain movies that come along where you're kind of like, I just want more of that thing you gave
right.
me, just give me
yep.
more of it. And that's kind of yep. where I think we all were with the first Spider-Man movie. And I think this is, you know, we'll get into this, but it's one of the brilliant things about this movie is it manages to give you a lot of those things that you got from the first one and kind of satiate that desire while also throwing you a little bit of new and a little bit of different concepts here and there, and kind of winding up being this great middle ground between something new and something familiar.
And something borrowed and something blue as well.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. And the borrowed blue thing in this case is Spider-Man's suit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that being said, folks, one of the things we like to do on Off the Page, as you all know, or maybe you don't know, and if you don't know, I'll tell you. We like to watch along with the audience if you have a chance. Now, if you're in your car, if you're at work, totally cool. You can still listen to it. It won't be hard to follow, hopefully. But if you're at home and you're listening to us, fire up your DVD, your Blu-ray, your whatever digital version, and we're going to give you a chance to dig that out. You can pause the show right now if you want. And when you come back, we are going to count you in. And what we're doing is we're watching it on mute with the subtitles. And we're not going to watch the whole movie. We're just going to use it to kind of remind us of things here and there that we want to talk about or discuss. So if you want to get yours going, we both have ours ready to go. And we are going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And I think this is probably the most important aspect of the movie. This, of course, is the opening logo for the movie studio here.
Yes,
cool. We're seeing the
Columbia Pictures.
Columbia Pictures, yes.
You know what's crazy, and maybe it's just a part of my old age, but you know, the older I get, the fewer movies I get a chance to see in the theater, and it's like the only actual studio logos I ever see anymore are pretty much Warner Brothers and Marvel, and so it's always weird to me to see these logos for films that I or for companies that I used to know like the back of my hand and barely recognize
right.
now.
Yeah, that Marvel logo, by the way, was this the first time it got used in a movie?
I don't remember, honestly, and it's one of those things that may have been tacked on retroactively to home video releases, so it's kind of hard to speak with authority on that. I mean, X-Men would have been the first – well, I guess Blade and the Blade – when did Blade 2 come out? Because Blade was 98 and Blade 2 was what, 02?
01 or 02.
Yeah, so like X-Men and Blade would have been the first opportunities for it, and then first Spider-Man, obviously.
Yeah.
I've always liked the opening credit sequence to these movies. I think it's cool, especially for Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3, where they kind of, you know, recap the events of the previous film without you having to sit down and watch it. I think it's a cool idea. I think more movies should do it.
Yeah, this is great. Alex Ross.
You all right over there, Greg?
Hello?
You all right over there?
Yeah, I've been talking the whole time.
Okay.
Can't you hear me across the L-shaped studio?
Vaguely. But anyway, let's go. Let's continue.
Anyway, what I was saying is Alex Ross art here. Mm-hmm. Here on this opening title sequence. This was actually a really cool opening here to this movie, and it's kind of similar. Not similar, actually. It's actually very different from what they did with X-Men, which also had a very cool opening sequence, mm-hmm. And kind of set the stage for, and in some ways set the bar for opening title sequences for these superhero movies.
Which we don't really have anymore these days. Like the idea of the opening title sequence is not really a thing. This is a very old school decision on the part of Sam Raimi, but it's one that I think serves both this movie and its inferior successor, Spider-Man 3, to a great degree.
Yeah, and it's a style that's kind of fun. Like, you know, it's an interesting way to draw. Nowadays, you're just kind of dropped into movies a lot. Mm-hmm. And back then, this was kind of the standard, was to have a title sequence introducing the actors and whatnot. And I feel like this is one of the better ones. And so was X-Men. And this was kind of an era when you had a lot of creativity involving that. And this kind of also sets the stage for a movie that does feel at times like a comic book.
Yeah,
but in a more organic way than something like Ang Lee's Hulk, which was trying very obviously.
Yeah, which was trying to create like literal panels on screen and whatnot. Yeah, I agree.
And here we start the movie, and they're just kind of setting the stage of the status quo of Peter Parker after the events of the first Spider-Man film. He's been Spider-Man for a while at this point. I think for 2 years. Is that correct?
Yeah. Aunt May makes reference later in the film. She specifically says 2 years since the death of Uncle Ben. So,
and so he's established as Spider-Man, but he's still having that famous Parker look where nothing goes right for him. He's trying to work as a pizza delivery man, not doing a very good job at it because he's trying to balance that with being Spider-Man, and he just cannot seem. He can't get right.
Can't get right. Pizza Yurt. What an interesting name for a place.
Yes, very much so.
This is a good time to mention this movie, by the way, is sponsored by Dr. Pepper, in case you couldn't tell. Dr. Pepper, that's right, Dr. Pepper. Look at there, Dr. Pepper.
You didn't go where I thought you were going to go with a Dr. Pepper reference, and I'm glad you didn't go there. I appreciate and respect the fact that you didn't, Nick.
I'm confused as to what you even mean.
Well, you didn't, I dare not even give an utterance.
Oh, no, come on.
You didn't make any mention to the temperature of the Dr. Pepper or the the accent of the individual.
I see what we're doing here. I get it. I follow what you're talking about, that little sweet guy with Diet Dr. Pepper. I get you.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. That's the ticket. So, this whole...
He's rich, biatch!
Yeah, it totally is that guy. I was trying to place him.
It's Ashy Larry. Earlier.
It is. It's Ashy Larry.
Or Beautiful.
There he is.
Depending on your preferred Chappelle Show character.
I go with Beautiful.
I like Beautiful as well. Ashy Larry is just the one most people recognize more.
Right.
That is, getting off topic once more, is there a more underrated sketch in the history of Chappelle Show than the Player Haters Ball?
I don't know that it's underrated.
I think like it is. I think when people talk about like the 5 or 10 best Chappelle Show sketches, it's often left off the list.
I don't think it is now. I think maybe at one time it was. I feel like it's now become...
earned its rightful place in history?
Earned its rightful place in history as being amazing. Now, I'll tell you what's underrated. was the one from the cut sketch from season 3 where they go back in time. That one's underrated.
Well, that one is like just an entire thing of like the player haters and increasingly bizarre situations. Because doesn't that also have like the gay KKK or whatever in it as well that they have a face off with or something?
I can't remember that.
This actress in this scene, by the way, looks familiar, and I can't place her.
I'll tell you in a minute. I love this scene, by the way. This is a great physical comedy scene for Pete. That's another thing about this movie. I haven't watched this in a long time, and it's a lot funnier than I remember it being.
Yeah, and a lot funnier in, like, most people, when you would say Spider-Man humor, you would think in a more sarcastic, witty, like, rapidly flying dialogue kind of way, kind of like what you get in Homecoming and even to a lesser degree in the Amazing Spider-Man sequels. But this one, and I'm gonna use the term slapstick, but I don't mean it in a negative fashion. This just has a lot more of that than you would expect, especially like if this movie were made today, none of that would be in there. Is the way?
Yeah,
the physical
humor aspect of kind of a guy where just bad stuff keeps happening to him.
Right,
funny bad things happening. By the way, that actress you were thinking about, I'm almost positive this isn't her, but I know why she looks familiar to you because her face looks very similar to Alexandra Daddario.
No, I feel like she played somebody. I don't know. I'm trying to look her up right now, so you continue talking.
That's who I thought it was at first, was Alexandra Daddario. And I was like,
I know why she looks familiar. Apparently, it's Zooey Deschanel's sister. So she looks
really?
Like Zooey Deschanel.
Emily Deschanel.
Yeah, from Bones.
Bones, yeah.
Yeah, that's who that is.
All I've got are my bones. Right.
I don't know what you mean by that, but okay.
She was also in the
ultra-filling Nicole Kidman film, Cold Mountain.
Cold Mountain.
Elizabeth Banks in 04. Not awful.
That was Elizabeth Banks?
Yes.
Wow. I guess I didn't recognize her as a brunette. Anyhow, J. Jonah Jameson here. This is our first chance to check him out, and he's brought over just as much amazing charisma as he brought in the first movie. Maybe there have been casting choices as good. Has there ever been a better casting choice than this? Than this J. Jonah Jameson.
It is
J.K. Simmons.
Like, I am trying to think about how great it is. It's difficult to put into words. Like, there are great casting decisions that work out. Like, for example,
right.
Heath Ledger as the Joker. He gives a great performance. He gives a great take. But you can do that character a variety of different ways to the point where Heath Ledger isn't necessarily essential to portraying that character on screen. With this, to veer a little bit off topic, then I'll bring it back full circle, Greg. Did you know they're making a live-action version of The Lion King that's coming out, like, next year?
No, I did not know that.
Okay, well, my point here, the reason I bring it up is because they're recasting all these roles for The Lion King, you know, to do a CGI/live-action movie, and they're casting all these new people in these familiar roles, and they had the wisdom at one point to go, you know what? Is anybody really going to do the voice of Mufasa better than James Earl Jones? And they realized the answer was no. And so instead of forcing a recast, they just cast James Earl Jones. If they ever get around to doing JJ in the Homecoming franchise, don't reinvent the wheel. Don't try to be too smart for your own good. Just get J.K. Simmons to do
what?
It. The wheel, so to speak.
Thank you. And they will get around to doing JJ at some point, and I agree with you completely. There at this point, to me, there is no reason to ever have anyone else play J.J. Jameson.
I agree.
And honestly, it's not like there's any age component to Jonah.
No, there's not. You can make it whatever you want it to be, you know?
Right. You can make him as old as you need. It's not like you need to age with Peter. You can just make him old.
And given the status of things over in the DCEU corner, it's not like he's going to be tied up doing Commissioner Gordon stuff.
That's right. That means instead of focusing on the width and the girth of the mustache, he can just focus on the prettiness of the mustache.
But no, it is one of the most perfect casting. It is, you know, it's a bit role, so it's hard to put it necessarily on this level, but it is Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark level good. Like, that's the only one that honestly comes to mind if you're looking for a one-to-one comparison. Because I think, as we've discussed before, you know, Chris Reeve as Superman, Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman, you know, Chris Evans as Captain America. Those are all things that, like, are great in their own right. But I think it's conceivable to at least imagine somebody else doing it at some point or another and it being somewhat effective. I can't imagine anyone ever playing J. Jonah Jameson other than J.K. Simmons or anyone ever playing Tony Stark besides Robert Downey Jr. and it ever working. I mean, those two actors are so tied to those two characters in my mind that I can't divorce myself from it.
Agreed. The primary difference between them, to me, is that Robert Downey Jr. took a comic book character and transformed him into his own personality.
Right.
And J.K. took a comic book character and literally became that comic book character.
Right.
In a way that, like... And you know what's even weird? Go back and watch the 90s Spider-Man cartoon. And retroactively, the guy doing the voice of J. Jonah Jameson on that show sounds like J.K. Simmons' J. Jonah Jameson.
Yes. One of the great travesties of the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon is that, you know, it was such a terrible show that it caused people to not watch more of J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson.
Right. So we've established at this point that J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah is awesome and brings all of that back to this one. Here we see a scene that is introducing us to the rest of... Again, we're still setting up the status quo. What is Peter's life like at this point, 2 years in the future from what we saw in the last movie? He's still friends with Harry Osborn, who's played by James Franco here. But they have a little bit of tension now because all Harry knows about his dad is that he was killed, in his opinion, by Spider-Man from every appearance. Because Norman made Peter promise not to tell Harry about the Green Goblin.
And because Bernard, for some reason, is intentionally withholding that information from him.
Oh, we'll get to Bernard in a little bit, my friend. I'm going to give you a chance, and myself a chance, to talk about our old friend Bernard. And I do mean old.
Good Lord, he's just so old.
Why didn't Bernard and Aunt May ever hook up in these movies?
A physical impossibility, I'm pretty sure.
Work, damn it. So
Swedish made penis and larger pumps than me. This sort of thing is my bag, baby. Signed by Bernard.
By Bernard. Not Bernard.
Bernard. That is important. You must note the pronunciation of the name.
That's right. Peter would be stuck with a guy named Bernard. That's different. Bernard aside, so Storm and Norman to Harry was this kind of distant father figure that was murdered by this menace known as Spider-Man for no reason. As far as Harry knows. And Peter, while he's still best friends with Harry, Harry sort of resents the fact that Peter knows Spider-Man and is kind of has a relationship with Spider-Man and won't tell him who Spider-Man is and help Harry get his revenge on him. So there's a little bit of tension there between them. There's tension between Pete and MJ because he is intentionally trying to keep distance between them, even though they were bonding in the first movie, because he doesn't believe that Spider-Man can have a relationship because of the, you know, the cliched superhero stuff at this point of, you know, he'll put her in danger if his enemies find out about her. But at this point, that wasn't really cliche because you didn't see a lot of superhero movies at that time. So setting up the status quo, and that's what I think is so great about this movie. You've gotten all of the character establishment essentially out of the way in the first movie. The only new characters that you see here of any importance are the villain, Dr. Octopus, and you know, you could argue John Jameson, but again, not a
John Jameson character. Is barely in the movie though.
Like, yeah, he's barely in the movie. Yeah,
it's such a weird thing that I'm sure we'll discuss this more in depth as we go along. But like, one of your three co-leads in the movie, arguably in Dunst, McGuire, and Franco, and you have one of them get into a marriage subplot and barely feature their fiance at all. It's a really weird decision on the part of Raimi, I thought.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's hard to look at the movie. It's already 2 hours and 7 minutes, I think, and think about, well, they should have cut this, because the one thing about these movies, I can't remember the third one as well, but the first two, they are hyper-focused on Peter. He is the focal point, with the only exception being occasional cutaways to Doc Ock. And for everything, every scene in this movie serves the story, in other words, that they're trying to tell. And I think that in that case, it's all through the eyes of Peter. So Peter is learning this new information about MJ that he previously didn't know. Here's a scene that where she just casually drops information on him that she's seeing somebody right now.
Mm-hmm.
After stroking his face and petting it, like Tommy petting his sail. Right here, petting his face. Now, wouldn't that... I'm not good at reading signs, Nick, but isn't that generally a sign that a person likes you?
Yeah, that should be a pretty, you know, pretty good sign. Which she did. I mean, she kissed him at the end of the first one, so you know, he should know that she's into him or whatever.
But he doesn't act; he just stares.
What about the fact that he just asked her if she was still in the village, and she just ignored the question? I mean, when a man asks you a question, woman, just answer it. And here she is casually, "Oh, I'm seeing somebody new."
You mean like a boyfriend?
This is very manipulative on her part. I, in hindsight, I have become less and less of a fan of this version of MJ as I get older. It is not ideal in my mind.
Well, I'm kind of two minds about it, Nick, and we'll address more of that here. I think in some ways, I think that's kind of in a way why this relationship works is because they're kind of both like real people in the fact that they don't ever really say exactly what's on their minds at a given time.
Yes,
manipulate one another.
I'm not debating that MJ could potentially be realistic in terms of her being manipulative. I'm just saying she's a bitch and therefore somewhat unlikable when she does these things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think she's a complete bitch in this movie. I think she has some decisions that are like that, but I think Peter makes some bad decisions too. Peter's a guy that always tries to do the right thing.
But right.
I think in the process of trying to do the right thing, he unintentionally does things that hurt people around him.
I agree with that, but I guess my point is MJ does things that she knows aren't right at various points, and they hurt Peter, and they hurt other people around her.
Was this,
and then you couple that with, I don't think the performance is very good either.
Was this, that landlord is creepy as hell, by the way. Was this
skinny landlord's daughter? I thought was going somewhere because they have her pop up in the third one, and it's just one of those things that is like this random side path that Sam Raimi decided to go down with no real intention of ever fulfilling it.
I'm not going to hold what doesn't happen in the third against it, but the way I read it was kind of setting her up almost as possibly an alternate love interest for Peter, but maybe at the time, I mean, when I saw this movie, I thought, well, maybe this is Peter's kind of chance to move past MJ,
right?
You know, and accept his Spider-Man role, but that's not how it plays out. It's kind of like a red herring, I guess you would say. But anyway, so the three leads we set it up. But yeah, what I'm saying is, what makes this so cool is origin movies, by their nature, have to get bogged down in introducing this entire cast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've shed those shackles. You pretty much only have one new character you're introducing in this movie that's a major character, and that's your villain.
Right.
And everybody else is established. We care about them. We know who they are. And you're able to hit the ground running, set up the status quo in the early going of the movie, and then you don't have to tell us what Peter Parker's personality is. You don't have to tell us what MJ's personality is or what Harry's personality is. We know. And so you can just get right to the story, right to the plot, and right to the established character interactions. And I think right out of the bat, we're seeing Harry has changed a little bit from the first movie. He's, quote, maturing a little bit, but he's still that immature, you know, cocky kid that he was in high school. Just now he's thrust into a role of a corporate executive and clearly isn't really ready for that emotionally or mentally. Now we also meet Otto Octavius, not Otto Schmidt. And Otto Octavius is a character that I would argue we've been over this before on the show, and I've made this somewhat controversial remark that I think this is another example of a movie drastically improving a character from the comics counterpart.
And every time you knock on Doc Ock from the comics, I kind of wonder what Spider-Man villains you do like, because you know Spider-Man has, I think, inarguably anyway, in terms of Marvel solo heroes, the deepest rogues gallery of anyone, and you seem to have a disdain for a lot of his villains.
I do. I'm not making any bones about that. Disdain is a strong word, but listen, I can tell you, when I was a kid, if Dr. Octopus was on a comic cover, I wasn't going to buy it because I found him lame. I thought he was a one-dimensional, one-note character that looked like Elton John.
He not did exactly. have some Elton John-like tendencies in his character, but the idea of Doc Ock, to me anyway, that's always made him interesting, is the advantage that Peter has over the vast majority of his rogues gallery is that he's smarter than pretty much all of them. The two glaring exceptions being Norman Osborn and Dr. Octopus.
And the Lizard.
The Lizard, you can kind of have that debate, because Connors and Peter at various points in the comics have kind of been portrayed as being fairly equal, you know, in terms of being closer to being peers almost in intellectual level than Osborn or Octavius. But the point being, and to me that was always why they interested me, is because Peter was actually going to have to figure out how to beat these guys, because he wasn't going to be able to just outsmart them at every turn. So I always dug Octavius, personally.
I don't know. Ultimately, didn't it usually come down to somehow tricking Doc Ock into tangling his arms up or something? Or shocking himself? Kind of what he does here.
I mean, if we're talking exclusively like 60s and 70s Silver and Bronze Age stuff, then yes. You know, later stories were not as simplistic as that.
My point being, yes, I don't like Doc Ock in the comics that much. Now, modern Doc Ock could be different. I don't know. But the traditional Doc Ock never appealed to me. I never particularly liked... there are a lot of Spider-Man villains I didn't particularly like when I was a kid. I can't help it. But I did like others. I liked Venom as a kid, which I know is somewhat controversial in some circles. But
what
I
circles? Like what Venom. Circles is that controversial in?
Some don't like, not just Russell. Russell's our friend, and he doesn't like Venom very much.
Didn't say anything about Russell. You said that.
Some people else. A lot of people don't like Venom. Actually, it's pretty.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I don't think liking Venom as a villain is necessarily a controversial opinion. Is all I'm saying. I think it is.
A kid, but it became one as 90s comics became less cool.
Oh, so, God. The anti-90s comics thing is right. That's a good point. That is a growing movement that has come along.
I enjoyed the Venom, and I enjoyed the Carnage to a degree. And I liked some of the weirder Spider-Man villains, too, like Mysterio. I always thought Mysterio was interesting. Because of
my only issue with Mysterio is that I feel like Mysterio and the Chameleon should both not exist at the same time. Like, I feel like it's very redundant to have those two.
The worst was the Rose.
I don't even remember that.
The Rose was a kind of a lame character. I like some of those. And of course, I think mine and Russell's both favorite, other than Harry, our favorite Spider-Man villain. Not Kurgan.
Craven the Hunter.
Why did I get Kurgan stuck in my head?
I guess you just had Golga and
who was the other one?
Oh, God. Golga and Kurgan and fucking hell.
Giant Silva,
yes. Yeah. And Luna, right?
I was thinking, and Luna. Yeah, I was thinking more Truth Commission Kurgan.
Yeah, and I was thinking Oddities Kurgan. After all, that was our unfortunate introduction into the insane clown posse in professional wrestling.
God.
A thing we could have done without, I'd argue.
They would later become active roster wrestlers in WCW.
Yes, I'm aware of that. That's why I said it was a thing we could have done without.
But hey,
he can't afford things. He's poor. That's the joke there.
You know what's a great thing is Mike Awesome gives that one ICP guy the Awesome Bomb on the top of the Fat Chick Thriller van.
They should bring back ICP
and
have
slides off and falls to his doom.
They should bring ICP back and have him feud with Brock Lesnar.
I'm good with it. The ICP and the Singh Brothers versus Brock Lesnar in a handicap match.
Where they literally have it in an Olympic stadium, wherever the shot put is held, and they just see how far each one can fly.
we've diverged wildly.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, when's that ever stopped us before?
Never. Never.
Never. So, I don't even remember what the hell we were talking about that said all
that. Who knows? You know what's great about this scene?
Spider-Man villains.
You know what's great about this scene, Greg, right here?
What's that?
95% of it is practically done.
Yep.
Like that is one of those things that I continue to get hung up on, especially rewatching a lot of these movies. Is, you know, I am not as anti CGI as you are, but I have come to the conclusion that I prefer the Chris Nolan approach. Whereas use CGI only when you must, and if you can do it practically, do it practically.
Right. And that's the one of the things that we will get into, and we might as well get into it now. This is a movie that came out in 2004.
Right.
Now, at the time,
yes,
when it came out in the theater, this was the most cutting-edge CGI I think that we had seen, right, maybe outside of a Star Wars movie.
Right.
This was cutting-edge technology. This was like nothing
top
we
shelf
had ever seen. Nobody criticized it at the time.
No.
Now, in hindsight, some of these scenes stand out. Like some of the beginning of the movie when he was swinging in daylight through the city.
Yeah.
Pretty fake looking.
Yeah.
There's a scene at the end of the movie in particular where there are these just blatantly fake CGI helicopters, right, that show
up. Or even just now in that chase sequence when he was sitting in the car, it was very, very clearly like the old like 70s style, you know, the car is practical, but they're just like a moving set of images behind them rather than actually filming on a street or something like that. So,
right.
You know.
But that being said,
I am sorry, we keep getting sidetracked, and this never happened, and I typically hate these sort of fan theory, fantasy booking things, but the Bruce Campbell as Mysterio thing should have happened if Spider-Man 4 was ever a thing.
Yes. Yes, I agree. This is a great scene, by the way.
Yeah, he's great. He's great in every single, like, all three roles he plays in this trilogy are all great.
For those that aren't watching with us, Bruce Campbell as the usher.
Yes.
The condescending usher that will, I've been in situations like that where there's been a condescending usher who has scolded me for my behavior in a theater. So, even as an employee of a university that is putting on said performance.
Oh my God, the subtitles are cracking me up because it's not just for this Asian lady singing. It doesn't just say spins a web any size. The subtitles actually say "Ah, spins a web any size."
So Campbell playing this condescending usher is great.
Yes.
And again, the way that they get across the Parker luck in this movie may be done better than any of the other movies that I've seen because the guy just cannot catch a break.
Right.
Like, and that's, and isn't that all, hey, that was a subplot they never explored right there. But I think that's something that everybody identifies with, you know, that's kind of the ancient tale of Spider-Man is people identify with him because you're young, you're awkward, you feel like you have bad luck, you're not popular. And so Peter Parker's all of those things, and then he can put on the suit and get to escape that for a brief time and become something else. And I think this does a good job of establishing just kind of what a crappy life he has right now.
Mm-hmm.
His the girl that he's madly in love with is dating another guy. He's trying to be Spider-Man and trying to help people, but in his personal life, nothing's going right.
Yeah. I would tend to agree with that.
And here's a clear homage to Richard Donner's Superman.
Yeah, I mean, clearly. But there's nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and here, like you mentioned earlier, it is the CGI is more glaring when it's daytime. At nighttime,
right,
this doesn't
looks great.
It doesn't bother me, you know, even today.
No.
Hey, granted,
no,
now we should both mention, Greg, that Greg and I are each actually watching full screen DVD versions of this movie because we've never upgraded. And back then, when we had square televisions, full screen was a thing. So we're not exactly watching in the optimal picture quality, but you know, we're doing the best we can to comment on the visuals.
Yes. Now I can already hear some of you sending emails to the loneliest email addresses on the internet, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com, and you're saying to us, oh, hard-traveling fanboys, why would you disrupt the director's vision by getting a damn full-screen picture? Even when you had a square television, you should have got the widescreen, just dealt with the letterbox format. And I suggest to you that if you want to watch black bars take up 70% of your screen, that's your prerogative,
yeah,
quite frankly.
I don't mind widescreen now that large televisions are actually affordable, but do you remember how much large televisions cost back then, Greg? Not to mention the fact that if you bought one, the things weighed like 400 pounds and were impossible to move.
Yeah, I got one sitting in my room right now that I'm going to have to unload when I move here in a few weeks.
Yeah, so like, yeah, no. I had a small television. I was in college at the time,
yep,
or high school,
yep,
at the time, and then college shortly after. You know, I got widescreen because I had to maximize my minutes. And by minutes, I mean my screen size.
It is like a good friend of mine used to say, the big cat Ernie Ladd, he'd say, I'd rather fight a man than love a woman.
I don't know what that has to do with anything, but
that's your opinion. Who is this guy? That's what I was going to ask Nick when I was watching this earlier. This guy, I know him. What is
yes.
He, who is he?
I believe his first name is Hal. He featured on, if you remember the VH1 series, I Love Thee, the 80s, 90s,
yes,
and 2000s.
That's where I know him from.
Yes.
Yep.
He was heavily featured in that as some sort of comedian. I'm not really sure, you know, what his actual claim to fame is, but that is what we know him for.
And that was a good scene, too. The particularly the kind of rides up in the crotch line was particularly clutch. Which begs some questions. I mean, that's got to get uncomfortable after a while.
I'm trying to look up this guy's full name.
And here's another scene that dates the movie, a payphone.
Hal Sparks is his name.
Hal Sparks, yep. I'm familiar with him. So here Peter has to use a payphone as opposed to a cell phone.
Yes.
That was still a commonly used thing. And he leaves the message here for MJ. And another example of the poor Parker luck as his call limit runs out and he doesn't have enough change on him to continue the call.
You may have also known Hal Sparks, Greg, in the crucial role of skateboarder in The Adventures of Lois and Clark.
No.
Yeah.
Could not tell you that. But I can tell you that I guess we should get on to the character of Mary Jane. This is a character that you have grown to despise over the years.
That's
a strong word, but a character that you no longer have an attachment to the way that people did when they first saw these movies.
Yeah.
And I get that because I've never been, as you know, in my Spider-Man reading, I've never been a huge MJ fan in general. But I think that, the characterization in the movies I've always been kind of okay with, but you know, nothing, you know, she's not Emma Stone's Gwen Stacy from The Amazing Spider-Man.
She's not even close to Emma Stone's Gwen Stacy.
But I do think
controversial opinion. She isn't whatever that actress's name is, Liz Allen or Liz Toombs from Homecoming.
At least
Liz is nice to Peter. Like, MJ in these movies
at times,
but then she veers so wildly between like being fond of Peter and then being a complete bitch to him. Like earlier, like later on in the movie,
he lies to her constantly.
Later on in the movie, Greg, we're going to get to this, and I mentioned this earlier on the phone with you. She is going to say to Peter, you know, after all these years of friendship, all you are to me now is an empty seat. And what years of friendship is she talking about? In the first movie, she barely acknowledges him until, she breaks up with Flash. And there's only 2 years that have passed. So what are all these years of friendship? What is this great debt that you feel Peter Parker owes you? You know, like, it's ridiculous. You lived next door to the guy practically your entire life, and you've only started associating with him in the last 2 years, and all of a sudden he owes you all these things? Screw you! Shut up!
Well, they're supposed to be best friends.
Yes, but that is
the first movie.
That is, you know, that has only been a thing for the last 2 years of Peter's life. You know, you don't know what he has going on.
Her point is, Harry Osborn shows up to her stuff. Her ex boyfriend, by the way.
Harry Osborn doesn't have any responsibilities because Harry Osborn has that old fuck money.
He's running his dad.
Harry Osborn is running the meat sauce mafia and nothing else at this point.
He has to run a multi-million dollar corporation. Yes. Her new boyfriend.
I'm sure that Harry Osborn is actually calling all the shots and not just being a figurehead.
Her new boyfriend, American hero John Jameson, has attended 5 of her performances.
Well, that's because he's an astronaut. And when he's not in space, what the fuck else is he going to do?
Oh, that is a disrespectful comment. Didn't Apollo 13 teach you anything? Astronauts have to
sit around and wait to be called for a moon mission? Yeah, they sure do.
They have to go through the chambers and whatnot.
My point being that, like, of all the people...
They have to eat the banana chips and whatnot.
Of all the people she references in that little monologue about how all these people have come to her show, the only person in a similar life situation to Peter in terms of financial situation is her dad, who she instantly mentions, yeah, and he begged me for money after the show. So, you know what? Shut up. Peter's got to work. Stop being such a bitch about it. And stop being like, stop trying to hold stuff over his head that you really don't have any right to hold over his head.
And
if we're talking about the character in general, we are talking about just this film today, but you kind of have to take a holistic view of the character and the way she was approached in the trilogy, and Spider-Man 3 does her no favors whatsoever.
Spider-Man 3 does no favors to several characters, including Peter, but...
I am saying that in terms of her, like, her portrayal and, you know, her relationship with Peter, to me, it was a law of diminishing returns. And it is the only aspect that got worse throughout the series as opposed to better.
I would say that, in my opinion, I think that MJ in these movies, I think when I was younger, I took more of the viewpoint of why is she being mean to Peter? And now I get it a little bit more. I don't think that if she was more one-dimensional, I would agree with you. But she clearly has feelings for Pete, and she clearly cares for Pete, and he just keeps pushing her away constantly. And then trying to get back into her life, and then she's saying, no, look, either you're in or you're out, and clearly you're out. And then he
only a Sith deals in absolutes, Greg, which is, by the way, an absolute. So,
of course. So ultimately what we're getting at is you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life.
I'm just saying that, like, I find the character to be inconsistent, and I understand part of that is intentional to attempt to capture some of the wishy-washy nature of MJ from the comics, but I think they do it in a poor fashion here because they use MJ's wishy-washiness as exclusively, you know, the only thing she ever does is wishy-washy is her attitude towards Peter. Like, she's manipulative towards him. She's blatantly manipulative later in the movie towards John Jameson, which we ultimately don't care about, you know, because we don't have any reason to be attached to that character. But she's not a very good person in these movies.
I don't really see how she manipulates Peter in this one. I see it more as...
Well, we just talked about that earlier scene where she goes on this long, like, they're having this long conversation. She's, in, you know, stroking his face with her hands, and then she, like, walks away and casually drops on him, oh, by the way, I'm seeing someone. Greg, that is as manipulative as it gets. Come on. Like, I'm here with you. I want to praise this movie, and I love most things about it. MJ just sucks.
To a degree, I can agree with you that it's... I mean, I don't think manipulative is the word I would use. I think the thing is... She clearly cares about Peter, and she wants him. She clearly wants to be with him, but she knows that he's lying to her, and he won't be honest with her, and he won't show up to these things, and he won't be supportive of her.
Sorry,
in the way that she wants him to be.
I had to laugh because if the red flashing lights weren't enough, they had to pop up "system unstable" on the screen in giant letters to make sure everyone understands there's some sort of
which
issue.
Also used to pop up, I believe, when the WCW tag team High Voltage would come to the ring.
By the way, in a series of like cameo appearances in this movie, the guy who was running that console was actually Daniel Day Kim. He would go on to Lost fame as the character of.
His real name Daniel Day Kim, like, yeah. Daniel Day Lewis?
It's D A E. You know, Daniel Day Kim. He's done other things as well, but that's predominantly where people would know him from would be Lost.
Who plays Doc Ock's wife here? She's familiar as well.
I do not know the answer to that question. I would have to, once again...
The Shadow knows.
Yeah. My point being, like, in a movie that is full of things to praise, I think MJ is the one area that this movie really opens itself up to some realistic criticism on.
And I only halfway agree with that, because I don't dislike MJ the way that you do in this one. I feel there's blame to go around in there. Struggling relationship.
There is certainly blame to go around, and then it's just, you know, it's all about how you process that blame, and Peter tends to do it in what I would argue is a better fashion than MJ.
Fair enough. I will say there are few worse actions other than trying to blow up the city in the movie worse than MJ's waiting until their wedding day to decide that she doesn't want to be with John James.
Yes, and also basically without his knowledge holding a kissing audition, you know, to make sure that she wants to marry him. Like, she is clearly...
That's a good point.
That's what I said. Like, she is, like, even if you do want to disagree with me about manipulating Peter, how is she not being a complete bitch to John Jameson?
Absolutely. No, you're right about that. And how did John Jameson have a dad like J. Jonah Jameson and turn out to be so noble?
Well, you know, there are numerous instances of that throughout history. Look no further than my own situation, so there you are.
Quite frankly.
More so than probably any scene in the entire trilogy, this is like the one scene where Sam Raimi gets to let loose with his heart. I mean, because that's what he is at his heart.
Yeah,
Sam Raimi's a horror director. Yep. And this is his one chance to let loose of that in terms of the way that the entire scene is framed.
We haven't even talked. We've been this whole time talking about you know, the main player, so to speak. We haven't even talked about Alfred Molina much as Doc Ock. I started going that direction, and we got, you know...
We got sidetracked with me complaining that you don't like any Spider-Man villains.
Right. Which is not exactly true, but as I mentioned. But this scene is awesome.
Yes. And
this is Sam Raimi 101.
Yes.
Horror over the top, but scary, and a way to make Doc Ock scary. Because I never... That's the other thing about Dr. Octopus in the comics. I was never afraid of him. Like, he was never a character that made me think, oh no, Spider-Man's fighting Dr. Octopus today. Even when they did the famous rivalry with... Eric Larson and... Tim would know. Eric Larson and... Peter David, actually, were having a pissing contest because Peter David had, I'm probably getting this backwards, actually. It probably was Eric Larson that had Doc Ock beat up the Hulk, and so Peter David got pissy about it and came back in the next issue and had the Hulk beat up Doc Ock.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I never really bought him as a threat, really, as a scary threat. And in this movie, this scene alone does so much to make him a scary, menacing figure.
Now, you know, I can't speak too heavily about the classic 616 interpretation of the character, so I'm not really sure how much of that found its way in eventually. I know the 60s stuff I've read, it was not there. But this movie does something that the Ultimate Universe had done when they introduced Doc Ock very shortly before this movie came out, to make me think that it may have been a, you know, something. I don't know if Bendis was playing off what he knew was going to be in this movie, or if they took some inspiration from what Bendis was doing. But the idea that the arms are kind of a personality unto themselves,
mm-hmm.
that was in the Ultimate Universe, and this is something that I actually like, and I think does make itself a little bit more interesting than the just straightforward interpretation that I've seen in the 616 universe.
Right, I agree, and that's something here is that they establish, by letting us meet Otto before the accident, we see that he's a brilliant scientist, but we also see that he's not unhinged really in any way. He's maybe a little bit too obsessed with his work, but he has a good, happy marriage. He's a happy guy. He's a nice guy. He kind of takes Peter under his wing a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and mentors him a little bit. And by making, by establishing that aspect of his character, to me, it instantly makes him more interesting than a mad scientist.
Here is
he's turned mad. He's turned mad by these arms, these artificial arms that have this artificial intelligence that's mm-hmm. bonded to him, and it kind of turns him mad. But he's not, in and of himself, a villain, so to speak.
Agreed. Just because he's on screen right now, barely. How, you know, in a pretty solid franchise, how short, you know, short change was Robbie Robertson, by the way?
Yes, he pops up occasionally to just kind of be bewildered.
Yeah, and to say things like in vague defense of Spider-Man, but Robbie's kind of one of those characters that, you know, throughout the publishing history just became gradually more important, and they don't really treat him with any of that level of importance here in these movies.
If they have Robbie in the new Spider-Man series, you know it's going to be Kenan Thompson, right?
Oh, God. Robbie doesn't have to necessarily be fat. Like, you can cast a skinnier Robbie, I think.
Well, I'm just saying, he's there. He's there, and he can do it.
He could do it. You're right.
So Doc Ock is just one of the best the best aspects of this movie. Oh, yeah, this is a great
what
scene.
For those
not watching, Peter goes in to J. Jonah's office, and J. Jonah asks him to go shoot this gala event, and Peter goes, "Can you pay me in advance?" And Jonah proceeds to laugh, and then stop, and then laugh some more. It's terrific.
Yep.
So yeah, Doc Ock's one of the best parts of this movie. He's Alfred Molina gives a stirring performance here and adds pathos to this character in a way that I don't think anybody was expecting going in. Because Doc Ock, even if you like Doc Ock, okay, he usually wasn't presented in the comics with anywhere near this level of
no
depth.
No, he's more of a, you know, he is one of those people who delights in his misdeeds at times, and this is not. You know, this is definitely not that. This is a more conflicted, sympathetic version of the character that, yeah, that I actually really
gradually
enjoyed.
And gradually getting turned crazier and crazier by these artificial.
One thing I want to
devices of his creation.
I want to praise right here is, you know, a lot, we've talked about CGI a lot. The CGI on the arms actually always looks great, even
tremendous.
Now. Like,
yeah,
it still looks really good. So,
and even a little scary, the noises they make and stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm, every time that he does something or says something that doesn't go along with what the arms want to do, their reaction is kind of scary. Like, it's like this kind of tense moment where it's like, okay, things are changing. And now you can see them starting to exercise more and more control over his psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of an interesting concept, too, of the creator. You know, we're used to the, you know, the Frankenstein thing where the creator is undone by his own creation. We're not used to the creator creating something that then corrupts him,
mm-hmm,
and kind of controls him. So that's a pretty interesting aspect, and creates a one of the best villains probably in a superhero movie for me, for my money anyway. I'm still to this day a huge fan of this version of Doc Ock. The complexity, the effects, the way that they realized the arms in a way that made it look cool and menacing. Really good stuff here.
Yeah, I would agree.
Is that okay? Is this Joel McHale, right?
Yeah, it is. My God, this
what
movie,
a great cameo!
Movie is just packed with these
that, people who become big stars.
May not have been cameos at the time, you know, but kind right. of are in hindsight.
In hindsight, yeah, Joel McHale would go on to some great level of fame, and here he's just a loan officer who gets kicked by Aunt May.
Right.
But yeah, so poor Peter, he's just, you know, his grandmother's about to get evicted, or his aunt, not his grandmother, his aunt who is older than his grandmother probably, is about to get evicted.
Well, not evicted, she's trying to refinance her house, and he denies
well,
her.
Well, yeah.
And he's like, well, at least I get the free toaster. And she doesn't get that either because she's old and doesn't understand that nothing is free in life. And she's gullible and can't read fine print. That seems to be the joke here.
And the back was wearing a Vince McMahon suit as he walked down the steps. And here's going to be our first action scene with Doc Ock and Pete. So, oh, the poor Aunt May. I felt so bad for Aunt May in the scene when she says, don't leave me.
And Peter just runs away, and they never address it again. Like I feel like that's something Aunt May would have probably got back around to at some point. Yeah. But like, hey, what the hell,
Peter,
man?
Peter, are you that much of a coward? Again, I think, and I wish we had Russell on this episode, because I'd love to get his take on this, because I've always read between the lines and kind of assume that she kind of has figured it out at this point. Maybe
also,
I'm wrong.
Apparently,
maybe
this is a bank
too much credit, but that
I was gonna say, apparently, what? This is a bank dealing exclusively in 1780s or, you know, 1780s pirate currency of gold coins being thrown all over the place.
Bullion,
yes.
And here, Peter's having a lot of trouble getting it up in this scene.
Yes, he is.
But yes, so we've been, Aunt May is she's kind of a hidden treasure in this movie, Nick. I have to say, I don't remember her much in these movies at all, as far as like making a big impression on me. But I was actually really impressed by her performance here, and kind of some of the subtle lines that she gets here, and the subtle shade she gets to throw a couple of times in this movie. I really enjoy Aunt May here. What do you make of the, I always forget this actress's name. She's such a
Rosemary Harris.
Great Rosemary Harris. She's a really terrific actress. And
yeah, she does really good. This is definitely the more traditional take on Aunt May, where her the exclusive like point of her character is to be old and deliver sage old person advice with an occasional like cutting comment in there, and she does a very good job of that, even though it isn't necessarily the version of Aunt May that I am most attached to, as you know, but still a really good really good job of doing this.
This is the classic Aunt May, and she's so good here doing this, and they give her a little bit of agency in this one too, because as in this scene in particular, she's the one that actually saves Peter, as opposed to the other way around. Mm-hmm. He saves her several times, don't get me wrong. But she gives a well-timed whack to the noggin of Doc Ock.
If that had been the Amazing Spider-Man 2, it would have broken her neck just now.
That's true. That's true. Now let me ask you this. Oh, there's Stan.
There's Stan.
In Blink and You'll Miss It cameo. Yep. Maybe his shortest cameo in any of these movies, right? Or the quickest, anyway.
I would think so, yeah. What were you going to ask me?
Now, she was hanging there, but now when we see in a second, we're going to see that she actually has clear footing right underneath her, which is kind of funny, too.
I don't think she realized that, though, at the time was what they were
going Yeah, for. No, she clearly didn't. She just drops down to it. But this is now, see, this scene looks a little, you know, CGI-ish. It is, obviously.
It does, but I like the visual there of Spider-Man tangled up in the arms and stuff. Like, it's
And one thing about all the fights in this movie, I don't know who choreographed them or storyboarded them or if Raimi did that himself, but all of the fights in this movie are just brilliantly storyboarded. Like, whether they're CGI fights or more practical fights, they tell stories, they make sense, they serve the story of the movie. There are challenges to be overcome within the fight. I think that this movie is the A1 example of how to take a comic book character and his action scenes and convert them into a movie, and in a way that establishes exactly what makes that hero different. These aren't just martial arts fights. These aren't just generic action fights.
Shame
these
on are you. Fights that she has to say it.
Yes. These are fights that only Spider-Man could have. Mm-hmm. You know, there's webs, there's acrobatics, there's flying around. He's not standing there and just slugging it out with Doc Ock. He has to come up with angles, create ways to get advantages over Doc Ock and his advantages. That was a unique shot. It's just a remarkably well-done movie from an action standpoint, and how well it holds up also surprised me to a degree. The level of, I think, thought that goes into these fights is better than it gets credit for. And, you know, we'll talk about probably the most iconic action sequence from this movie, and one of the most of all time, which is the train sequence. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just think the action in this movie in general is really well done.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, that sequence there, you know, the closing action sequence isn't that great, but that's just because I think that that sequence that we just saw, and as you referenced, the train sequence, overshadow it so much that it probably just feels less than comparatively. But yeah, that train sequence is just it still holds up so well. And you know, honestly, for a guy who doesn't really have a reputation as being a great director of action to this point, I think Raimi in all three of these movies gave us good action scenes in every one of them, which is remarkable.
Yeah, and you know, whether it was even the scene where Peter is just going through saving people,
right?
You know, whether it be the road chase or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they are really, really well done action sequences. And right now, we're going to take a diversion because Harry is. I can't tell you how excited I was to watch this movie, Nick, and to see a good Harry Osborn again. Because I feel like, honestly, like Franco didn't really get appreciated in at the time, because you know no one could have known how bad the next time we'd see Harry Osborn would be.
So yeah, that's why I was kind of wondering. Like, what are your only comparison? I guess is Dane DeHaan, which is unfair at best. I would say,
but. His Harry Osborn was horrendous.
Oh, it was like, but no one, you know, could have made that.
But
good.
This reminded me that Harry, I think for me, was always one of my favorite characters in these movies, because I think Raimi does a good job of capturing the arc of Harry Osborn, which they missed so completely in the Amazing movies. Well, particularly Amazing 2, the only one that he was in.
Yeah.
Harry only works as a character if he has that relationship with Peter to start with.
Right.
If he doesn't, the character completely is useless. There's no point to him.
Right.
He's just another character with daddy issues otherwise.
I agree wholeheartedly, which is why I'm kind of hoping they'll introduce him in an Amazing Spider, or excuse me, in a Homecoming sequel, and just have them be friends for a little while, you know?
No, he'll have to be fat if they do that.
Not necessarily.
I think they should just make the Ned Leeds kid the new Harry. Why not?
Well, you kind of need the Norman thing there.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Basketball hair. That's the other thing. This movie does not, at no point in these movies, Nick, in this one, in the first one, or even in the third one, do we see basketball hair. And I want to know why.
Because no one has that hair, Greg. It is a thing that was drawn in the comics and, like, you know, it's the same reason that nobody has Rob Liefeld Captain America tits. They just aren't they aren't things that exist.
You're telling me it's 2018. Man has walked on the moon, for God's sake, Nick. Man has walked on the moon and we can't come up with basketball hair in a movie?
It's just not a thing, Greg. I can't explain that to you any more than that. It's like there is no real life equivalent that someone could look at to build that, you know?
I've got an idea of where you can start with. Hollywood scientists, if you're listening to if any Hollywood scientists are listening to this podcast right now, I want you to go back and I want you to watch footage of Jerry Lee Lewis, the killer. Performing around 1958-59.
That's look not basketball hair.
No, but look at his hair. Look at the waviness. It's the closest approximation. And I want you to find a way to take that.
Franco's hair here is pretty wavy. I mean, what are you wanting?
I mean, it's wavy, but it's Franco here. It's that, oh, I'm James Franco. Look at me hair. You know, it's different.
I would also argue that to most people, the basketball hair isn't nearly as essential to the character as it is to you.
To me, listen, if I'm defining Harry Osborn's characteristics, I'm saying number one, awkward,
man, this is,
daddy issues.
This is a very aggressive version of Harry here.
Yes, he is. Number two, self-deprecating and lacking in real confidence, even though he has outward confidence at times. And number three, basketball hair. Basketball. It's essential to his character.
Basketball hair.
There's John Jameson, the famous astronaut.
You will be glad to know that in the Renew Your Vows series, the alternate future series, his son Normie continues the tradition of basketball hair.
I remember Normie.
Even in 2024, he continues the tradition of basketball hair.
We haven't even talked about this amazing. This whole gala, or however you pronounce it, rich people party, is. Awesome, because, or maybe this is later in the movie. I think this was this one. Peter, every time he tries to get one of the free items of food at these things,
somebody else takes it. Takes the last
one. Then finally, at the end, he gets a free drink from one of these things, and he goes to drink it, and there's nothing in the glass.
Yes,
just an umbrella. Oh, tremendous, tremendous. So, good old Pete, his powers are failing him. So that's one of the subplots in this movie is the power failure, which I have to admit, over the years, this is one aspect of the movie that I've never quite wrapped my head around. Is it just a self-confidence issue, or rather a divided focuses issue?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of the two. His inner conflict causing himself to, you know, because he's so conflicted about what he should be doing at any given point, he feels like he's not really serving any particular area of his life to his fullest, and it causes an issue of self-confidence. And honestly, you know, for a movie that is kind of, you know, it's already at 2 hours, like we said earlier, and it has that John Jameson character that doesn't really develop, I don't really think the power failure subplot was necessary, honestly. Like, I think you can get across that question of whether he should be Spider-Man just through his relationship with MJ instead of having to have a physical manifestation of it. I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying one of the things I'm looking back at and kind of going, does it serve any greater purpose than what you're already setting up here, you know?
Yeah, I think for me the big thing was always it works, and I think it's out of the comics as well. He did something similar in comics back in the day. But I think for me it's like I'm kind of like you on that. It doesn't you know, certainly I couldn't make it better. I'm not suggesting that this could be better done a different way. I'm just saying that, you know, that's kind of an aspect of the movie that I've never really cared about that much. At the time when I was watching it, I remember thinking it was leading somewhere, like he was losing his powers or something, but it's kind of you know,
and here's this
a manifestation of his
hippie doctor who wears tie-dye shirts under his lab coat.
and sits next to Peter on the patient's bed.
If a doctor ever sat next to me when I was in my underwear, I would be very concerned. It would be on the level of a Southern preacher in terms of the creepiness factor.
How y'all doing? Welcome to service today. We're glad you can make it.
As I rub your shoulder for 30 seconds.
Yeah. Also, I have to say...
Which, it could be worse. I suppose there are other certain faiths that have worse reputations when it comes to physical contact.
That's true. Is it... maybe it's just different in New York, but I've never been to a doctor's office that had a giant skeleton in it either.
When I was a kid, like... They had one in the like doctor's off like the building, but not necessarily in the examination rooms.
That would be off-putting to me. I wouldn't want to be getting a rectal exam and looking at a skeleton while it's happening.
Why are you getting a rectal exam?
Yeah. Hey. What else am I going to do on a Tuesday?
Anything else? Virtually anything else?
Well. When the options are...
Here we are with Peter engaging one of his favorite pastimes, which is staring into space.
Oh, that's the other thing. This scene, I love.
This is great.
And I didn't remember it at all. Yeah. I didn't remember this at all. I didn't remember Uncle Ben being in this movie. This is great.
Yes, he's in all three of them, actually. I believe he pops up in Spider-Man 3 as well, and this kind of... I don't even know what this is supposed to be, but, you know, this idealized version of his car right before his death, I guess, where he and Peter have these conversations.
Mm-hmm. It's all going on in Peter's mind, you know, as he's kind of wrestling with his, am I allowed to have a life at this point? You know, it's kind of the question that he's asking. And it's very...
At this point, I'll be like, you said that already. You said it multiple times. You said it over and over again. I got the point. For God's sake, just let it go. You're beating it into the ground.
When he reaches out and Peter refuses to take his hand, I mean, this is just a heartbreaking scene that is carried by the performance of both guys, actually. Mm-hmm. But Toby in particular is, I mean, this is great acting here from Toby.
Indeed, it is.
Toby being Toby Maguire, who I don't know if we've actually mentioned, who plays Spider-Man in this movie.
And you've got, I believe, Oscar Robertson as Uncle Ben.
And also, Oscar Robertson was an incredible basketball player in his day.
I think...
The Big O, they called him.
Wasn't that Oscar Robinson?
No, it was Robertson.
Was it?
Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
You are thinking of the Admiral David Robinson.
I don't necessarily know that I was thinking of that, but fair enough.
You were thinking of Mario Ellie.
Cliff Robertson, not Oscar Robertson. My mistake. Cliff.
Yeah.
There you are.
Mario Ellie. Former wing player for the Houston Rockets and San Antonio Spurs.
And here he just throws his costume into the trash casually, which I understand is trying to homage the comics and whatnot, but...
It's not trying to homage, it is directly
homage. Right, I wonder if that's not the smartest, you know, usage of just... Wouldn't you rather just keep it in your room or whatever? I don't know.
Just in case you decided to use it later?
Yeah. Yeah, or just in case you didn't want people to know that Spider-Man was gone.
The
and here is Sam Raimi's, you know, something they'll do again later in Spider-Man 3. He loves these musical montages of Peter doing things.
Raindrops keep falling on my head.
Mm-hmm.
For those that may not have followed what we were talking about, there was just an homage to one of the most famous Spider-Man stories of all time, mm-hmm. Spider-Man No More,
mm-hmm.
where he decides that he's no longer going to be Spider-Man in the wake of all the guilt that he's dealing with. This is good, too. Trying to fix a bike. You punk. Man, now that, I will say this, Nick. If we're playing fantasy director, how do you not cast Arnold for that role as the guy that yells up at Peter in his balcony?
Something tells me, you know,
punk!
Arnold was
you
a little
bastard!
Busy. Was a little busy at the time.
You son of a bitch! What are you doing? You fuck! Something like that.
Here's what I want to know. The implication from their earlier conversation was, how was Peter already not flunked out of college by this point? Like, the implication was he hadn't done anything. Yeah, but you still have to turn assignments in, based on my understanding of how non-journalism majors work anyway.
You know. You know, there were lit classes I'd show up to every time, as I was the attentive student, and there'd be a guy that would show up, you know, three times a semester, and he managed to somehow make it through.
You know, as we've discussed previously, I think the way to improve this play that Mary Jane is in is rather than having it be the importance of being earnest, E-A-R-N-E-S-T,
right.
I think it should be the importance of being earnest, E-R-N-E-S-T, and Jim Varney plays her co-star here rather than this vaguely British guy they have.
I have no idea what the importance of being earnest is about. But
no, nor do I.
It would be much more interesting, I know this for a fact, if it were about the importance of being Ernest P. Worrell.
Yes, the importance of being Ernest P. Worrell.
That, now, that would be tremendous. And that would be a play that I would be mad at Peter for not. How can you blame Peter for not showing up to this, in all honesty?
Yeah, now I mean, if it had been the importance of Ernest P. Worrell, yes. But, you know, I kind of understand him not showing up to this play as it.
Yeah, I wouldn't show up to this play. I'll be, if you were in this play, Nick, I probably wouldn't show up to it. I'm just going to tell you.
You know, if I were in this play, I would hope you would show up and murder me. That would be my most sincere hope.
And I can't help but notice that in these scenes, not once is the name Ernest even muttered. So I don't even understand.
Yeah, this is really dumb. I don't get it.
God Almighty! Remember the Ernest off, the Earn off, if you will.
Yeah, where Saves Christmas was victorious.
Yeah. That, no, where it goes to jail was declared the greatest Ernest movie.
No, I think it was Saves Christmas.
That Ernest off could perhaps make a future countdown list that we put together.
We are approaching. I think next week is our 100th episode. So we're going to be rather self indulgent next week and talk about how great we are.
Oh yes, ain't we great?
Ain't we great? The answer? We're all right.
Yeah, it's all right. Andrew Garner will be our guest star. Yeah. He'll tell us how great we are. So, Garner, what did you think about episode 61? About the same as the other ones.
There was some stuff I didn't really understand the jokes, and you guys talked about wrestling and you know, 90s country music, and Clint Black. Oh.
Clint Black. Definitely the worst episode was the first one in which you mentioned Clint Black.
Clint Black, yeah.
Oh, God. Yep. Anyway, so what else? What haven't we talked about in this film? We talked about
MJ. We talked about Toby. We talked about – you know, we haven't really talked about Toby, though.
No, we haven't really
much.
Talked about Toby. Except
we've kind of gotten into Franco and MJ and Aunt May and Melina, but we haven't really – and JK, of course. But we haven't really talked about Toby that much. I know that was something you wanted to talk a little bit more about.
Yes, we talked about him in the scene with the rice maker, but we haven't talked about any other aspect of him.
The rice maker?
And – Uncle Ben.
Oh, yeah.
He makes great rice.
They want you to believe that in 2004, they were still literally pasting pieces of paper to design a cover.
Pasting papers together? Yeah, I noticed that, too. I was watching the back. I love movie journalism.
Yes, it is so, like, you know, movie journalism sets this unrealistic expectation. You know, one of the movies that I blame the most for having an unrealistic expectation of what the actual news life was going to be, Greg? Zodiac. Because in Zodiac, all Robert Downey Jr. does is drink and say sarcastic things and smoke openly in his office. It looked like my own personal version of heaven. And then I got into the business and it was far, far different than that.
Yes, whether Lois and Clark or Spider-Man or All the President's Men, every movie about journalism makes journalism look so glamorous. And then you get into journalism and you realize that it's mostly just sitting at your desk waiting for the phone to ring.
And living at the poverty level.
And living at the poverty level, yes. Most importantly, living at the poverty level.
Not below the level, but just right there at it.
Just right at it. Just enough above it to not qualify for any breaks.
Yes.
So, yeah.
What is up with this Asian violin lady they keep coming back to, by the way?
And what about how in the movies journalists get to travel internationally to cover stories?
Lois Lane gets sent to Antarctica to discover the Fortress of Solitude in Man of Steel.
Like, what? I was lucky to get mileage to Geneva.
You mean Geneva?
Geneva. That's
Lois Lane shows up in Africa undercover in Batman v Superman. Not saying it doesn't happen, but come on. You know, let's...
Yeah, and we've been over Daredevil and its version of journalism too, where the editor just never expects a story to be turned in.
Haven't seen a byline in 6 weeks. What are you working on? Oh, I'm still letting this one marinate a little bit. Oh, all right, then. Not you know the what? Way it works.
You know what? I'm going to back you on that.
I'm going to back you on that. I have faith that when you're truly ready to write a story, you'll have a story. In the meantime, we'll just run something else.
And when we do run your story, it's an opinion column.
Yes, on the front page.
It's taking a year to write.
Yes.
Oh, God. We actually do have a point about the movie I want to make, though. So, that scene at the grave, was it not amazing how much they made Tobey Maguire in that scene at the grave look like Steve Ditko's Peter Parker?
Yeah, I guess. Well, you kind of caught me off guard with that one.
Yeah, well, it just struck me when I was watching it again today, that shot of...
Like, oh, the tie and the glasses and all that.
The
tie
and the glasses and the hair kind of going up.
Yeah, they had to show him again for me to be able to actually see it, you know? Because we had gotten past it.
And now it's in the... I didn't want to interrupt. You were on a roll with the journalism. The
no,
journalism,
it's fine.
Right, so.
This scene is really weird to me. And one of the reasons it's weird is because this section of the movie, I think the point is kind of supposed to be that Peter's life appears to be a little bit better without Spider-Man. And this one feels like a random, like, wait a minute, stuff still sucks. You know, it's a weird... It's not a bad scene, and I understand that it's kind of necessary given that they are referencing, they kind of allude to this possibly happening in an earlier scene, but it feels like the only part of the sequence of the movie that kind of loses the central theme a little bit.
Here's where I think you're wrong about that, because I think this is the next wave of things going badly for Peter, because we also just saw him see a guy getting mugged and turn his back to the guy and walk off. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you could see his kind of inner turmoil at that. And I think that's why this scene makes sense, because they transition from that to Uncle Ben's grave, and suddenly the guilt that Peter has of walking away from a situation not unlike what he walked away from when Uncle Ben died.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good point. I just always took it as ultimately the thing that drove him back was his, you know, responsibility to Mary Jane, and this kind of felt more ancillary than that primary motivation, I guess.
Sure, yeah. I just love this scene because, again, it's a chance to see another heartbreaking scene where Peter recoils from Uncle Ben's hand in his head, and now here at the table, he reaches out to Aunt May, and she recoils
her hand.
That's
a good point. It's a good parallelism there. So
yeah, we brought up Toby, so I guess I should go ahead and get into him a little bit here.
Oh,
well,
my boy.
So I
love that Toby,
because over the years I've kind of undersold Toby Maguire a little bit. Mm-hmm.
And I know you have a bit of a bone to pick with general perception, so I'm gonna let you talk for a little bit.
Hmm?
I know you have a bit of a bone to pick with the general modern-day perception of Tobey Maguire, so I'm going to
The modern perception, because we, let's face it, we live in a cult, pop culture world where we're slaves to the moment. Whatever happens now is better than what happened before, or worse than what happened before. There's no in-between, there's no in-the-middle, there's no... and we've talked about this in the past with the Joker performances, with Batman performances, with whatever it may be. And I think the perception of Tobey Maguire has been lessened somewhat since these movies came out. Because I don't remember people complaining about Tobey in 2004 after the first two movies. I feel like the combination of Spider-Man 3's failure and the combination of getting a more comedic take on Spider-Man, particularly in Spider-Man Homecoming, that everybody's excited about after the dreadful Amazing Spider-Man 2, I think it has kind of shaped the perception that Tobey Maguire was never really Spider-Man to begin with, that he was playing some different character and wasn't really inhabiting the role of Spider-Man. And I think it's fair to say that the Sam Raimi movies did not have the punchline-spewing Spider-Man like perhaps you would expect to see. But what I noticed watching this movie is, to me, Tobey Maguire absolutely inhabits the character that I read as a kid. It's not the Spider-Man of the swinging 60s, necessarily. It's not the... And he does have some punchlines in this one. He has a couple of funny lines in this movie. but it's not that constant barrage that you might expect from the cartoon or from, you know, from some of the comics necessarily. But the character that I read in the comics when I was a kid, the kind of conflicted, tortured character that had really bad luck as Peter and enjoyed being Spider-Man, I do get that sense here. I see a guy that lets loose when he's Spider-Man and is able to have a little bit of fun, and a guy who is constantly at odds with himself for trying to do the right thing as Peter Parker. And I can't pick any holes in his acting in this movie. I think he acts the hell out of this one and actually shows genuine and real emotion throughout the entirety of the movie as I get a barrage of text messages. I think that he inhabits this role and portrays it, to me, the best of anyone. Tom Holland was great in Spider-Man Homecoming, and I have high hopes for him going forward, but I haven't yet seen him make me feel anything the way that Toby does in at least three scenes in this movie. And that would be the Uncle Ben scene, the Aunt May scene at the table, and the MJ scene at the end. Mm-hmm. I feel like Toby is awesome in this one. He's underrated historically for his Spider-Man performance. It's not a Heath Ledger. It's not even an Alfred Molina kind of like transcendent performance. But what he does is he plays this character and he makes me feel like I'm watching Spider-Man that I read when I was a kid. That's something Andrew Garfield never did. And that's something that Tom Holland has done, but hasn't had a chance to sink his teeth into yet to the emotional level that Toby does. So Holland's able to be a little bit funnier, a little goofier, but Toby was really emotional and really made me believe that I was watching a real person on the screen. And I think that's a big compliment to pay him. So I was actually very impressed with Toby on this rewatch.
Yeah, Toby does a great job. I'm not going to disagree with you there. I think where we kind of venture, you know, diverge from each other a little bit is Toby does a great job with the version of the character that is written for him here. But the version of the character they're writing here, while it has it checks a lot of the boxes, it doesn't check enough of the boxes for me to be considered the best Spider-Man. Like, you know, you've got the emotion down pat for sure. And like you said, they really lean into that whole, like, everything in this guy's life is kind of going badly. And while that is certainly an element of Spider-Man, I'm not arguing that isn't an element of Peter Parker, I feel like that's the only area of Peter Parker they really have any interest in exploring here. And there is more to him than just constant misery. You know, his unwavering optimism in the shadow of that tragedy is certainly part of his character. And they never got the quippy, like, you know, you talk about how here in these movies you get to see him let loose a little bit when he's Spider-Man. He never got to let loose enough. Like, their version of him in the suit always felt a little bit more restrained from a dialogue perspective than either of the two respective versions of Spider-Man we've seen since then, in both Andrew Garfield and Tom Holland. I mean, if we're comparing him to the other ones, I think ultimately he's probably a little bit better than Garfield, I guess. Even though I think Garfield's version of Spider-Man is better than Toby's, and Toby probably gets the nod in the Peter Parker respect, but I think Tom Holland checks more of the boxes for me in terms of what I'm looking for than Toby does. So I would give the nod to Tom Holland based on his two appearances thus far in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's fair enough. I think that Spider-Man 2 is a movie that almost would feel weird if it embraced that totality of Spider-Man because of the place where he is in his life. I think you could argue the first movie certainly could have had more comedy Peter in it. I just don't know how it would have worked in a movie where Peter is this much at odds with himself.
Yeah, but the idea is that he's Spider-Man is his outlet, and so all these bad things are happening in his personal life, and he, you know, that only causes him to be more irreverent while in costume. He has to have an outlet for those things, and that's kind of the way I viewed it, and one of the only areas of this franchise that I felt like just completely missed the mark in that regard. They just didn't seem that interested in Peter saying much of anything while in costume, or at least not anything entertaining, you know?
Right. So, we haven't yet talked about the subway scene, or not the subway scene, the train scene.
Yeah.
Now, arguably, would you say probably the most famous scene in this movie?
I would think without question, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. Didn't know if you had any other suggestions for that, but holds up amazingly well. I mean, it made my list of the best superhero fight scenes that we've seen. Just incredible CGI that holds up. Practical effects that hold up, of course, because they're practical effects. And telling a story of heroism that is unlike anything we had seen to that point.
Yeah, even more so than the fighting itself. Like, I don't think the punches that are being thrown and him and Doc Ock doing battle is necessarily, all that groundbreaking. It's cool to look at, don't get me wrong, but the story being told in that action sequence is just remarkable. I mean, it is not simply action for action's sake. It is a remarkable job of telling this story of heroism. I agree with you there.
Would it be fair to say that the scene, it's an example of the scene picking a body part and telling a story?
In that case, the body part being your heart.
Oh. Well, I can't think of any better way to start winding this thing down than with that line. A truly heart-wrenching line from one Mr. Nick Duke. Now, the first thing I'm going to do is see Now a few more times. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I'm going to do is talk about final thoughts on this one. We've talked about, I feel like all the main players we talked about at this point, the plot's great. It makes, it's a really interesting story of Peter trying to come to terms with who he is and whether he can have a life while there's this Doc Ock storyline going on that is very compelling, that is interesting about this good man driven mad. And you've got subplots with Harry, which we haven't really touched on how that ends up here, but talk about a freaking missed opportunity, man. The ending of this movie is so good.
Yes.
The way that the whole wind down, the climax, and then the kind of epilogue, if you will, is so good. And I'm like, oh shit, not only does MJ know he's Peter Parker now, they're going to try to have a relationship. But now Harry knows, and Harry still thinks his dad got murdered for no reason, and now Harry's going to become the Green Goblin. I was so stoked at the end of this movie, Nick. I thought Spider-Man 3 would be can't miss.
I did too. And they overthought it from the beginning with the forced inclusion of Venom, and then, like, rather than just having him be the Green Goblin and truly carry on in his father's footsteps, they went with that bizarre, like, new Goblin look, which was just awful. Like, felt very 2000s, like, trying to speak to some sort of, and even at that point, a fad that was dying out, trying to speak to the extreme sports fad or something with the snowboard look and all that. Just a, we're not here to relitigate the failures of Spider-Man 3, but I'll agree with you.
No.
The issues with Spider-Man 3 could not be foreseen at the close of this movie.
Right. This one seems to be rare pre-MCU example of a great standalone superhero movie that also ends in such a way that it could set up a franchise of great movies to follow. There's no sense of a slowdown, I don't think, at the end of this movie, or a sense of finality. There is a sense of, I can't wait to see where this goes next. And it's another notch in this movie's column. So, we said we were going to have a bit of a love fest for this one, Nick. I don't think there's any surprises. We have a couple of little issues here and there with the movie, respectively. You perhaps a few more than me, but I think overall, both of us love this one.
Right? Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Holds up very well.
Yeah, absolutely holds up very well. I think where we disagree, I guess, if we want to have that conversation, is where it falls in the overall Spider-Man pantheon, because I think the primary difference between you and I is there have been 6 Spider-Man movies made to this point, and 4 of them I think are, I love or at least very much enjoy. And then I think there's one that is a little bit below average, and then I think there's one that is a train wreck of, a dumpster fire of Poolian proportions.
Ooh. Ooh, we really got a podcast to happen.
Yes, we do. But the primary difference between you and I is like...
I think there have been one great Spider-Man movie, one really, really good Spider-Man movie, one good Spider-Man movie, and then, a kind of a mishmash of average movies, and then an atrociously bad one.
Yeah.
So we're not here to rank all the Spider-Man movies unless you want to.
That's up to you.
Probably have to rewatch them in order to do that.
No, I mean, I have rewatched Spider-Man 2 and 3 in recent memory, and Homecoming for that matter. The only ones I haven't rewatched recently are the first Spider-Man and the two Amazings, but I have my Spider-Man movie franchise ranking pretty well set in my mind if that's something you want to engage in.
I guess we could revisit it in the future whenever we do some of these other ones, but I guess if I'm going off the top of my head,
mm-hmm.
I think, and this is probably going to be a diversion from us as well, but I think it's number one, Spider-Man 2, the one we just watched,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think it's even close. I think it's far leagues ahead of number two, which will be Homecoming, and then I think Homecoming is just a little bit ahead of the original Spider-Man, and then I think that is leagues ahead of Spider-Man 3, and then The Amazing Spider-Man,
mm.
and then somewhere in the subterranean level would be Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, and see, that's the primary source of disagreement for us in these rankings is I'm much higher on the first Amazing Spider-Man than you are, mainly because it speaks to an interpretation of the character that I have a very deep emotional attachment to. So for me, I would go Homecoming number one, and then I have to make a real, difficult choice between Spider-Man 2 and The Amazing Spider-Man in terms of which one I prefer. You know, objectively, this one's probably better, but there is a emotional connection I feel to that first Amazing Spider-Man movie that I can't deny. So I'd probably give that a slight nod, then this one, then the first Spider-Man, and then Spider-Man 3, and then Amazing Spider-Man 2. I don't even know how far behind the other ones, but the gap between Spider-Man 3 and The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is one of the largest gaps between comparable things that I can come up with.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. So, with all that being said, we want to hear your Spider-Man movie rankings. So your memories of watching Spider-Man 2 at the theater, on home video, what kind of impact did this movie have on you as a fan? Let us know. Tweet us at JRsBBQ. Tweet us at GPhillips8652, at NickDuke87. Join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just go to Facebook.com, type in Place to Be Nation Comics, join the group, we'll let you in, we'll have great conversation and discussion there. You can email us, as I mentioned earlier, GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com, NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. And please give us your feedback on this or any other topic you want to talk about. We will talk about it on the show. If you interact with us, we will bring that up
and
implement any changes.
In honor of Big Show number 100 coming up next week, let us know your favorite moments in hard-traveling fanboy history.
That's right. Do you have a particular favorite episode that stands out in the longest-running
weekly episodic comic book podcast? In all place to be nation. Good Lord, Greg. What are you doing there?
I think my connection must have been messing up because I was perfectly in rhythm with myself. But nonetheless, connection issues aside, in the L-shaped studio where we both are,
mm-hmm.
Yes, we would love to hear your favorite HTF episodes, your favorite HTF topics, favorite HDF rants, basically things to make us know that you're longtime listeners and make us feel good about ourselves.
Yes, we would appreciate some, not at all forced and begged for pats on the back.
Yes, verbal fellatio, very much encouraged.
Yes.
In fact, any type of fellatio, very much encouraged.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that.
With that said, we're going to take a little break here, folks. And when we come back from the other side, We urge you to stick with us as we get you the rundown, reading and watching, and maybe a little something else.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand Adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the next half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys show. We like to talk about comic books here, and, you know, one of those things that we like to talk about is a little segment, Nick, that features all the news and notes around the comic book world. You know what we like to call that segment, Nick?
I do not. I wonder if there could be some sort of musical interlude to inform us what that segment is called.
That is a good question. Let's pitch to the manager to find out more.
Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Yes, it is indeed the Rundown, Nick. That's that word.
Yeah, you know, and that's a great way to introduce that term through a jingle. You know, and quite frankly, I would suggest that if a show has a jingle, whoever, you know, whatever show has that jingle, the people who produce that show need to be grateful to the people who put in hard work and effort into those jingles. You know, you and I are very grateful to Todd, to the manager Todd Weber, and to David Sunday for the countless hours they put into those 15-second jingles. You know, it is just...
Absolutely.
It is,
when you're sitting at home, it may sound like it took only seconds or minutes to record, but we're talking about months in the recording studio.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And all I'm saying is, so if your show has a jingle, if you're a podcast host out there and you've got a jingle, just be grateful for it. You know, don't be ungrateful. Don't be disrespectful. Don't be insolent, as Dr. Evil might say.
Oh, Dr. Evil. He was a funny cat, that doc. But you know what's not funny, Nick?
What's that?
Superhero movies. They're serious business.
Well, sometimes they're funny.
And they're such serious business, in fact, that Marvel has moved the release date of Avengers.
Well, I don't.
Let me rephrase that.
I don't
Avengers
know.
Avengers Infinity War back a week, which has led. Let me finish. Which has led to serious business moves by other studios as they adjust their schedules to adjust to Marvel's adjustment.
Yeah, I don't know that Marvel necessarily adjusted the date because of it being serious business or something like that. I think that's a forced attempt at a transition on your part, but that's neither here nor there.
You don't know anything about my transitions. I'll have you know.
Greg, I have heard almost 100 consecutive weeks of your transitions now. Trust me, I know a little bit about your transitions.
I went to a work conference in Atlanta.
Yes, you
and
did.
When I was in Atlanta, I didn't have to fly anywhere, but I went to the airport anyway.
Yeah,
you know what
out.
People told me at the airport, Nick?
I don't know. What did they tell you? Something about your transitions, I'm assuming.
They told me that the Braves were going to be better this year than they were last year.
Oh, so the staff. So you're saying that the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was hanging out at the airport?
Yes, at the airport. Then I left the airport, and outside somebody said, "Hey, love your transition on the longest running weekly episode of Comic Book Podcast on the whole Place to Be Nation." And I said, "Thank you, sir." And he said, "I really loved your transitions on Geek and Sassy." And I said, "You bastard, you dirty dog."
All right.
Turns out, he thought they were the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast, and he thought I was a woman.
Well, you know, the problem with them is that they're not weekly. You know, they don't. There is nobody
right.
who can challenge for our throne at this point.
That's right. They don't know what it's like to sleepwalk their way through weekly podcasts.
They don't. They don't. You know, it is both a blessing and a curse to do this.
It is. It is. And why do we suffer? For our listeners.
That's right. For all 7 of our listeners.
That's right. So anyway, Avengers Infinity War is opening a week earlier, Nick, which doesn't really affect us in any real way.
No. Hey, it's exciting, though. I get to see the movie a week sooner. You know, like, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gives us a little bit more breathing time, a little bit more space between the Avengers and Deadpool, which I think is appreciated.
You know, and that's the only part of this that I think is even worth discussing. Is it possible that they moved because they were worried about Deadpool? At least on some level?
I think, yeah, dividing the audience, perhaps.
Right. Because, I mean, there's no question it was going to get...
Wouldn't it be in Marvel's best interest if both movies are highly successful?
Well, yeah, but I guess I'm looking at it in terms of, okay, look at Black Panther right now. Black Panther has had no competition since it's been released.
Right.
It's dominating the box office. And undoubtedly, Infinity War was going to dominate the box office for 2 weeks, but that third week, Deadpool's going to come out, and I think it would have been open number one. And done the lion's share of business, right?
Right, yes.
This way, Marvel gets to control the box office for another week. And it just, it's interesting to me because think back, you know, even 5 years ago, Greg, after the first Avengers movie, the idea of Deadpool, of all things, being any sort of a financial threat to the Avengers, it was...
Was ludicrous.
Ludicrous. And now, it's not. And that's just, it's such an interesting, you know, commentary on the way things have played out over the last few years.
Absolutely, it's competition is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
and competition can lead to controversy. And as you know, Nick, controversy
makes money. It does. That's true. Controversy does create money. That's why you need to stir up artificial drama on social media constantly in an effort to portray a character because it will create money for you. I think
that's exactly right. I think it's in your best interest to. Publicly air dirty laundry whenever possible.
Yep.
In an attempt to seem cooler than you actually are.
Yes, I agree.
So that's also a good thing to do.
Yes.
Now, speaking of things that are relevant to the topic at hand, Marvel also has made some pretty big announcements with their upcoming initiative, their relaunch, of course, their rebranding in the coming weeks.
The fresh start.
Month or other. The Marvel Fresh Start Initiative, and one of those I know particularly piques your interest.
Yes.
That is the somewhat controversial and unique announcement of the somewhat controversial and unique figure known only as Spider,
mm-hmm.
taking over as the new writer of The Amazing Spider-Man. So, Nick, what are your thoughts on Spider taking over as Spider-Man writer?
We should pause to probably explain the Spencer, you know, bit. For those of you who weren't listening to the show back when Secret Empire was a thing, you will recall, perhaps, that the controversial premise of that event saw Captain America turn to Hydra, and some believed it, you know, openly endorsed Nazism, which there's a strong argument to be made for that in the context of which the story was told. But so angry were people that they refused to refer to writer Nick Spencer by his full name, instead, you know, replacing many of the letters in his name with various symbols and expletives. And so Greg and I took up the running joke of calling him Spencer. So now that we've explained the joke and thus rendered it no longer funny, let me continue on this talk. I've come out and said, you know, been on record as being one of the people who liked Secret Empire. I didn't have a problem with the concept, and I think it was largely, for 9 out of the 10 issues, a very well-done superhero event. Granted, as Marvel tends to do, they struggle to stick the landing, but, you know, the event building up to that was really good, really solid, in my opinion. Nick Spencer also had a pretty good run on Captain America, Super Soldier, or Steve Rogers Captain America, what I've read of it anyway. Now, granted, it also deals with the Hydra stuff, so a lot of people dismiss it out of hand. I've read a little bit of his comedy book, The Superior Foes of Spider-Man, that was great. And he also wrote some stuff late in the existence of the Ultimate Universe, that, from what I understand, that was pretty good. So, you know, what I've read of Nick Spencer's stuff, I generally like. And I've made no secret of the fact that I think Dan Slott's Spider-Man is an abomination from hell that should have never lasted as long as it did. So the fact that we're getting rid of Dan Slott and replacing him with a writer that I generally respect the work of, I'm really pumped. You know, I'm a huge Spider-Man fan who hasn't read Amazing Spider-Man in years solely because of Dan Slott. So I'm excited to be able to jump back on that title starting with the number one. Then you throw in the fact that while I am not overly familiar with Ryan Ottley, there are many people who say he's one of the best superhero artists going today based on his work on Invincible. Marvel getting him in the bag to come draw Spider-Man, it seems to be a true all-star creative team, at least in terms of what's available to Marvel from a writing standpoint right now.
Yes, I enjoyed what I read of Nick Spencer's Superior Foes of Spider-Man. It was a very didn't last very long, but I liked what I read of it. It was only a couple of issues. I was pretty ambivalent about his Captain America run, but I think it's interesting to see new blood there for Spider-Man, for sure. And I'm particularly excited about Ryan Ottley to see what he has to bring to the table. I've never read Invincible, but I've seen some of the art, and I've always heard great things about his work. So it should be an interesting ride.
Yep. Can't wait.
Now, one of the other things that got announced was the impending return of a prominent Marvel character from the first decade of the 2000s. Which is the alternatingly interesting and or Superman stand-in, the Sentry, as he is returning in the Fresh Start initiative and getting his own ongoing series, compellingly enough, written by Jeff Lemire, drawn by Kim Jacinto, and it will be spinning out of his recent return in Doctor Strange. And it will delve into the psychology of the Sentry, a.k.a. Bob Reynolds, which is compelling, because I think the Sentry, as he was first envisioned, was very compelling. The sort of psychological and mental aspects of this character were very intriguing. And then slowly he just got turned into a Superman stand-in and eventually became a laughing stock character of sorts. A laughing stock character of sorts, in my opinion. And a story that received some acclaim at the time, 10, 12 years ago, whenever it was, that I didn't like was World War Hulk. And one of the reasons I didn't like it was because the Hulk was written to be this invincible machine that that practically, for all intents and purposes, beat everyone in the Marvel Universe that's a superhero. And then the only thing that can beat him is the Sentry. And they just punch each other until they both collapse. And they both revert to a primordial form. And then Bruce Banner and Bob Reynolds are taken off in shackles or whatever. It wasn't a compelling story is what I'm getting to. It wasn't a compelling ending to such a story. And it wasn't that iconic, like, Superman and Doomsday beat each other to death moment, because they didn't actually die. It was just It was just they just got tired. They just decided, all right, well, it's a tie, you know? And it was not satisfying, you know? It is a type of finish that to me should be used more often. Folks, they went to a time limit draw, a 7-issue time limit draw.
I think it was only 5 issues, to be fair.
It felt like 7.
Your disdain for the way the Century was handled in that era of Marvel is good stuff. I like it.
It was. You want to talk? So many times I had to listen when I was a kid to Marvel fans talk about how overpowered Superman was. Overpowered. He's OP. Nobody cares about a character that's overpowered. And then the Century was more overpowered than Superman had been since the 1970s. It was ridiculous. And he was fighting, by the way, another character who was overpowered to a degree that Superman hadn't been since the 70s, and the Hulk, Greg Pak's Hulk. But that's another story for another time.
Good stuff. I have nothing to say. I just wanted to hear you bitch about the Century. Moving on.
Yeah, by the way, folks, all disclosing how the sausage is made backstage, I didn't even want to do this topic. I didn't find it interesting enough. But Nick insisted because he wanted to re-rant about the Century.
Yes,
so
that's true.
Blame him. Don't blame me. Or blame Canada.
A rare South Park reference from you. Wow. Those are few and far between.
Not to be completely outdone, DC Comics also had an announcement this week, and that is the announcement of a new line of Sandman titles headed up by Sandman co-creator Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
He will oversee a new DC imprint that will consist that will be called a special called Sandman Universe, and it will kind of spin off into 4 titles that will explore this incredible universe that Gaiman developed. The Book of Magic, The Dreaming, House of Whispers, and Lucifer.
Now, what I want to know is, will the House of Whispers ever make it into the wind?
The wind. Because you can't have a whisper without it going at some point into the wind.
The whisper in the wind.
Wind. Anyway.
You know, this is undoubtedly a newsworthy topic, but it's one I can't really talk about because I've never read any Sandman stuff. I know that's a massive gap in my fanboy knowledge in terms of how critically acclaimed it is and generally beloved, and looks beautiful from everything I've seen. I've just never read any. So I can't
– Right, same here.
I have nothing to say about this topic. I'm glad it's happening for those people who are fans, and it's good to see Neil Gaiman continuing to do work with DC. But other than that, I can't really comment on it too much.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with all that because I would love to get into the Sandman at some point, but it feels like a big time investment, you know, to really get into this series.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to find the time right now with us doing a weekly series, which we put so much time and effort into.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we also have another DC announcement, and that is that your boy, Brian Michael Bendis,
mm-hmm.
is bringing Jinx World over and launching 2 new titles
mm-hmm.
with artists Michael Gatos
mm-hmm.
and David Mack.
Yes. His Jessica Jones collaborators for interiors and covers, respectively.
These titles, Pearl
mm-hmm.
and Cover. And I'm going to let you talk about these for a moment since this is more in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, so Pearl is going to be done with interior from Gatiss, who is typically Bendis's Jessica Jones and Alias collaborator, with Mac being on covers, as he usually is. And apparently it's going to focus on a Yakuza tattoo artist who falls in love with her enemy.
She ends up joining the staff of head coach Bruce Pearl, right?
Yes, one can only hope. So heavy FBI involvement there. But no, like that one, you know, that book sounds interesting just because of the creative team, but the premise doesn't set my world on fire. It's something I'll probably read and trade at some point. But Cover actually sounds really interesting to me. This is one that David Mack himself is going to do the interiors for, which is very rare in terms of at least anything with the mainstream publicity for Mack to do interiors. And it's going to focus on a comic book creator who is recruited into the world of spies. So it makes for a really interesting kind of meta premise that, you know, I'm all about Love the meta stuff. So I am looking forward to reading this at some point. Bendis saying, who has a better cover story than comic book art and writers who get to travel the world and no one is actually paying attention to what they're doing? And we're going to have a lot of fun examining the world of espionage through the worlds of Comic-Con. Such an interesting premise, and seems like something that should be right up hardcore comic fans' alley. I'm looking forward to that one.
Oh, yeah. Both premises sound good to me. I'm always a sucker for comics taking place in Japan, mm-hmm. as you know. And yeah, that cover concept sounds tremendous. So looking forward to that stuff. Should be interesting to keep track of. And that brings the end of the rundown, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure we missed a lot of stuff, but we'll try to get it next week and have a little bit of a shorter first part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get right into it, man. It's time for that segment where we talk about what we've been reading and watching. It's a segment we like to call Reading and Watching.
Reading and watching. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
Now, Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
I have read something.
What'd you read?
Well, I dug into my stash of roughly 8-month-old comics that I've been...
Only 8 months? I think you're giving yourself a little bit too much credit there.
And I've dug through 2 issues of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps that I read this past week.
Mm-hmm.
I read Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 16.
Oh, wow.
And I read Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 17.
Yes, tell us about these comics from a year ago.
And these two comics were both excellent. Both were written by Robert Venditti. One drawn by Rafael Sandoval. They're drawn by Ethan Van Sciver. The first one is an issue that virtually the entire issue is a fist fight between Arkillo and Guy.
Oh, yeah, great issue.
And this was a great issue, yeah, complete with flashbacks to Guy's childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Draws upon inspiration to keep him in the fight against a vastly superior physical foe. So if you love Guy Gardner, this is the issue for you. And then the follow-up is number 17, where we see Guy have a shocking heart-to-heart moment with Arkillo as he's on his injury bed. And we also see Kyle Rayner regain the classic crab mask and become a Green Lantern once more.
Yes.
So another great issue. Both of these were great. If I had to rank them, I'd go 16 and then 17, but both were great issues.
Yeah, I remember those. Those were very good. I completely agree. So glad to hear you dug back into that and enjoyed what you read.
Yes. And that's it for reading. So let's move along, shall we, to watching.
Hey, our stories are back after another random CW break.
Yes, the stories are back, certainly it's interesting to see how things are shaking in Salem and what the next twist in the ever-evolving lives of super couples like John and Marlena and Bo and Hope are going to be as our stories continue.
I don't know what the fuck you're blabbering about.
Damn it! Thought I was doing a Days of Our Lives podcast again. All right, well...
would have to do that podcast with... literally anyone else but me, if you were going to do that.
Damn it. Well, Nick, when I make Days of Our Lives references, just think of it as like when you make Kevin Smith references to me.
The difference being that you've actually seen Kevin Smith movies.
I've only seen a few, though. You've never seen any Days of Our Lives episodes?
I honestly don't think I have.
Man, you poor sheltered child. You don't even know about the possession of Marlena? My goodness.
I know about Marlena, but
stories of our time.
You know, all I know about is the cigar and the little gold dress.
Yeah, he's got me off track here. My point being, Monday brought us back to the CW universe.
Yep.
And it did so with a show called Legends of Tomorrow that has just, Nick, it's batting pretty close to 1,000 this season. Man.
Yeah,
it's just
really
every.
Is.
Every episode out, Legends of Tomorrow just knocks it out of the park. This was another episode where, in this case, it's basically taking place back in the pirate days of Blackbeard,
mm-hmm.
who, as it turns out, is actually quite the coward.
Yes. Comical take on that character.
And so we get the rare episode that focuses on Amaya and also is interesting.
Yes.
So I thought this one did a – this one actually went a long way to making me – we talked about a couple weeks ago how they made us care about Zari, and now they're making us care about Amaya. And right. I think that was a brilliant move by them. She was far more entertaining in this episode than she often is. She's presented much more as a fully fleshed out persona. I love that she went along with the pirate act to the extent that she did. Really good episode as always with Legends.
Yeah, I agree completely. Enjoyed all the pirate stuff, even enjoyed the Sarah and what's the agent's name? I forget.
Ava.
Sarah and Ava on their first date. I thought that was a cool little subplot with them trying to have a normal night out and stuff. And then, you know, thought it had, good character development there near the end of the episode as well. So
right. They've done a lot to rehabilitate the character of Ava, mm-hmm. I think, in our eyes.
Yes. Yes, that's true. And, I like the episode, so we'll move on from that awkward sidetrack.
Tuesday brought us to Central City with The Flash coming back in an episode that shockingly involves country music.
Yeah.
Or at least what passes for country music. So,
yes.
The continued Eobard Thawne, for God's sake, the continued plot of The Thinker. As he attempts to, or she at this point, attempts to round up all of the bus metas, continues, and the gang learns about this new this country singer who has developed sonic powers. And they go and try to help her. In the process, Ralph ends up falling hard for her fast, and it leads to a fateful showdown with DeVoe, Clifford DeVoe, that is, in which DeVoe switches bodies once more from mm-hmm. one woman to another, taking over the country singer, whose name I've forgotten. And now she is DeVoe, as he mm-hmm. continues to not romance his wife enough for my liking.
Yeah, I think it's important. He's going through a lot of changes. His bodies, you know, obviously, there's a period of transition here, but it's important, I think, that he and his wife... You have to maintain that physical intimacy. You have to make sure that you're, really placing an importance on that, because that helps you to grow closer together and keep that emotional attachment. You know, there's a heavy correlation between the emotional and the physical. You see, and so
yes, unlike you, Nick, you have a lot more knowledge of this because you're married. I've not been married, but I've studied a lot of the
you've studied marriage from afar. Yes,
yes, a lot of the greats in their writings about marriage have written that. Without consistent physical intimacy, mm-hmm. the love can truly die. It can truly evaporate. And I feel like that may be something that the show wants to look at in the near future, particularly if they want to maintain the integrity of the DeVoe characters and their marriage, which appears, to, in my opinion, from my observations, to be essential aspects of their being.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree wholeheartedly. And undoubtedly, you know, you can see the love die once the physical fades away, which is why you see so many marriages end in divorce. So there you are.
That's exactly right. And as fans of professional wrestling, you know, we know all about that. You know, we've seen the love die for wrestlers such as Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Bret Hart, basically every wrestler that's ever lived.
Or been married, yeah. But in all seriousness, Greg, I like this episode a lot. I don't fully understand. I guess they're trying to say that, like, when he transfers into a new body, it causes that body to, like, decay or something, so mm-hmm. he has to constantly hop from body to body. But, mm-hmm. you know, other than that, that unresolved question, I really like this episode.
And I'm actually shocked by that, Nick. I thought her accent would drive you
nuts. Oh, the accent was awful. But, you know, there were certain redeeming qualities. The accent was awful. But getting to see everybody else back after the break was mm-hmm. good, and getting Ralph kind of being smitten with her was funny and stuff. And you know, we just have to come to expect at this point, Greg, that they're never going to portray Southern accents realistically, especially not on a CW show. So you know, that is what it is. But I still like the episode, and you know, as I said in our group chat, the country music chick, I'll allow it.
And my overall summation of this one would be, it was all right. I was really happy to see the show back, but it was just kind of, you know, by the numbers, Flash. But you know, again, even when it's by the numbers, it's still pretty good. So, now also on Tuesday night was Black Lightning, and they took a random 1 week break.
Winter Olympics, you see.
Yes, Winter Olympics. Ratings juggernaut Winter Olympics. And
God, I wish that was a sarcastic comment, not a true one.
Right. And we had talked before that break about how Black Lightning finally reached an episode that felt samey, felt safe, felt, you know, overall not that impressive, right?
Right.
Not bad necessarily, just kind of bland.
First time you can see the wheels spinning a little bit.
Right. Well, in my opinion anyway, and we'll see if you agree, because I haven't talked about this ahead of time. I thought Black Lightning bounced back in a big, bad way last week. Came back with a hard-hitting, social-focused episode that, to me, picked up on the threads of the first few episodes in a way that almost made me question at first whether it was meant to air earlier than it did, because it picks up a lot of the threads of the first episode where the older daughter, Anissa, is an activist. We haven't really seen her be an activist much since then, and here she's back in that role big time. And again, I thought this was a tremendous episode. Mm-hmm. We get to continue to see the development of her powers as she becomes Thunder, and the continued mystery of what the deal is with, I can never remember his name, but the tailor, the guy that is helping Black Lightning. Yeah. We continue to see a little bit more unraveling of his thread of what exactly his deal is. And we see that he has stronger ties to the bad guys than we initially thought. And of course, Tobias Hoyle continues to be a compelling villain. And the acting continues to be strong. The writing continues to be strong. I loved this one, man. I thought this was a really great episode of Black Lightning.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. You know, continuing the Anissa subplot, getting to see, you know, Jefferson Pierce get a few answers as to what's going on with him. The interesting parallels they're drawing between what is going on with him physically and what happens to the users of this green light drug. Enjoyed all that. And then, of course, this Gambit character, while I still don't think it's being very well portrayed, at least it's being written in an interesting way to where I wonder if perhaps there isn't some sort of massive twist coming with him at some point. So I am intrigued to see where that character is going.
He definitely feels like he's playing both sides of the fence.
At this point,
He wants to. It feels like he wants to protect both Jefferson and Tobias, which is interesting. So I've been a fan of all of that, and it's just an excellent show, man. Another killer. All right, so let's bring it on to Thursday night and Green Arrow and Friends on Arrow.
Good Lord.
So this was an episode that put the teams truly at odds with one another.
This was an episode that had me like, you know, maybe it's truly a hallmark of a great episode, Greg. Maybe it is, you know, because it's a lot like pro wrestling where there are very rare occasions these days where I set my knowledge of the inner workings of it aside, and I genuinely want to see one party get pummeled at the hands of another party. And that was pretty much what this episode was, because by the end of it, it was like I wanted all of the new team to be crippled brutally or murdered outright. Yes. Like it has reached a point where there is nothing, not a single thing redeeming about any of those characters.
No, not even Dinah.
No, because they've arguably made her the most insufferable of them.
Oh my God. So basically, this was an episode that has Oliver and Felicity and Diggle trying to get to the bottom of where this money is that had been extorted from Caden by Caden James. The money is now gone, disappeared into the wind, and they believe that Laurel is the only one who knows where it is. And of course, she's not going to give it over willingly. And her dad's been protecting her after she was nearly killed at the hands of Black Canary, who is still out for revenge for her dead lover, the Vigilante. So Black Canary and her team are trying to find Laurel so that she can get her revenge. Oliver and his team are trying to find Laurel so that they can find this money and keep all of the essential services in the city from shutting down. And so we end up with a true civil war of OTA versus NTA, I guess, New Team Arrow. And let's just say that there is no question as to the fans' loyalties in this battle.
I don't see how the writers think this is... If the episodes were being written in such a way to suggest that New Team Arrow was actually the antagonist, or that they were actually the right. villains of this season, then it would be one thing. But they are being written in such a way to make you feel as if the writers are intending that we as viewers are to be conflicted, to be torn by,
no, there,
by
there
seeing these two
no
teams.
Conflict.
And there is no conflict. There's not even close to conflict. There is not even like the no. basis of understanding for a conflict. It is, I want to see them gone. Like, to me,
Oliver is the only thing, I've agreed with the new team on is killing Laurel. That's the only thing I've agreed with them on, and that's only because of my long-standing hatred of any of the characters that she plays. But I will say, you're right. Oliver's been right every step of the way. Oliver and Felicity and John. And that's what tells you, if Diggle and Felicity agree with Oliver on something, to me, that closes the case.
Yes, it's done. It's over. And not to mention, you know, I will give him a little bit of credit in this one. Other than Dinah, because she has powers... Old Team Arrow kind of pretty well handed New Team Arrow their ass.
I was going to say, best part of the episode, Oliver kicking the living shit out of Renee.
Yes. Because
which I could have watched an entire episode of.
Because they're not on the level, and they shouldn't be portrayed as being on the level. No. And they shouldn't have the bizarre, you know, the bizarre cockiness to believe they're on that level. I'm so over it at this point.
I know Mr. Terrific. And Mr. Terrific can't beat the Green Arrow. Now, can you argue with that? Can you disagree with that? Hell no.
And, like, it's reaching a point where, you know, the Damian Dark season, Greg, had some moments that were kind of eye-roll worthy and kind of, like, you kind of wondered what was really the point of it all. But I never actively hated a subplot from the Damian Dark season as much as I hate this subplot. Like...
Well, the good news is Renee's injuries were so severe that he has to be transferred to a hospital outside of Star City.
Yeah, but he'll come back in like 3 weeks. You know, it's just...
That's true.
I am ready for this thing to be done. I'm ready for it to be over, and I want Arrow... I thought Arrow had finally found its footing again after last season, and I am, you know...
Well, the thing is, just 2 episodes ago, they had an awesome episode.
Right.
So it's like... The season is still producing great episodes, but they're just like... They're being interrupted by these episodes of skips. Now, I will say this. I actually like the episode.
As much as
I've complained about it, I thought it was a good episode.
Too, but...
I just don't like these characters.
Right.
And it just proves me right what I've been saying for, three seasons now? 2.5 seasons. Let's remember that the show is called Arrow.
Right.
It's not called Team Arrow. It's not called Justice League. It's not called Justice Society. It's not Legends of Tomorrow. It's Arrow. Let's kind of forget about Mr. Terrific and frickin' Wild Dog, for God's sake. And let's remember that the main character of the show is Oliver Queen. And let's focus on that again, right? Let's forget about these bastard characters that no one wants. If you have to have Mr. Terrific, put him on Legends.
Right.
You know, if you have to have Wild Dog, why would you have to have Wild Dog? Make him an only occasionally appearing once in a while during the season character, like they had Wildcat on in the early seasons. Remember?
Oh,
he popped
yeah.
up like twice.
Yeah,
that's fine. I can deal with very limited Wild Dog. But enough of this. And to make matters worse, they're about to remind. I don't know if you saw the preview of the next episode, Nick, but they're about to remind us of a Team Arrow that I can deal with.
Yes, a Team Arrow that made sense.
Awesome.
Yeah, because it was a Team Arrow that made sense as opposed to just
yes.
a Team Arrow because Felicity thinks there needs to be a team, even though she no longer thinks
right.
that.
Right. We're about to get Roy Harper and Speedy back, so that's going to be pretty cool. So, yeah, I actually like the episode, but I agree it's way past time to finish off these jobbers. So, with that being said, time to rank them.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go first?
Sure, I'll go Legends at 1. I will go Black Lightning at 2. I will go I'll go Flash at 3 and Arrow at 4. And I ultimately liked all the episodes. I just Arrow frustrated me more than Flash did, is where I would fall.
Very good. I will go Black Lightning's back at number 1. I'll go Legends at number 2. I'll go Arrow at number 3, and I'll go Flash at number 4. And again, I liked all the episodes, but I thought Flash was a little bit underwhelming compared to what it has been at times. So there we have it. There's our rankings, and that's the end of Reading and Watching. Can you believe it?
No, it's not.
Oh, no, it isn't. No, it's not the end of Reading and Watching. That's right. Wait, there's more, because we've got, as if the death of Carl wasn't enough. Ladies and gentlemen, the king is dead. Long live the king. And by the king, I mean a group of useless characters that never should have been on The Walking Dead in the first place. The trash people are gone. Spoiler alert, the trash people are gone.
Yes?
They've been murdered. They've been killed. Simon finally did something right. And he stroked his mustache.
Hey, Simon grew that mustache. That's not the only thing he's ever done right.
He stroked his impressive mustache, swiveled his hips around, and then ordered his men to gun down all the trash people in an act of betrayal, except for Jadis, who was then forced to drop her act of not knowing how to talk because there are zombies suddenly, and sitting on top of a garbage heap and turning all of her former friends, subjects, countrymen, I don't know, turning them into a rudimentary paste via a trash compactor.
Yes, she certainly did that.
It was as if the writers of this particular episode took every fan complaint and every fan fiction written about the trash people and made it come true.
Except for Jadis living and surviving, so worried that she'll have a larger role to play going forward. But yeah,
other stuff happened in this episode, but I don't really care. Ultimately, it was about the end of the trash people.
While I definitely liked seeing the trash people come to an end, other than that, I thought the episode was kind of boring. Like, you had some good stuff with Rick and Negan having a little conversation, yes, but like, all this stuff about can we find a peaceful solution and all that crap, I'm tired of it, and we're only like 2 episodes into Carl's vision of the future being the new direction for the show.
The first half of the episode was very boring, I thought, but I thought the second half was very good with the trash people stuff and then the Rick and Negan confrontation. But I will say, another group, the next group of people that needs to be genocided on the show,
Oceanside.
Oh yes. My gosh, so boring. Every episode that involves them is boring.
Yes.
Is it not?
Every subplot of any episode that involves them is boring. Like, not good.
Oh, you just murdered my grandmother in front of me, but I'm not going to react to it. I'm just going to be oddly calm about the whole thing.
Yes. When you're focusing on Enid to be the most interesting part of a scene, I think that's how you know your scene has problems.
Yes, Enid of all people, Enid was having to carry scenes in this episode because everyone else was so useless.
Enid is a character that's been on the show for, what, like 2.5 seasons now? And I'm still not entirely sure what the point of her character is, especially now that Carl is gone.
Right. Well, she has no Carl is gone yet. So
oh, God, another scene of brooding. Carl moping. And that's exactly what we need on this show, as if we didn't get enough of it in this episode. Can't we all just be happy and move along?
I thought she was good here. The thing that is weird is, when did she and Aaron just have this awesome bond between each other?
The show does things, Greg. They just do things off screen. They develop these characters in these time gaps and expect you to just accept that the characters are vastly different people than when you last left them.
Now Aaron is a surrogate father for Enid? I don't know.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
But Enid did a good job. I thought, the thing that helps The Walking Dead every week, even when it has an off week, is I think, in general, the acting is very, very good.
Yeah, the acting is very good, even if the writing isn't. And it still has, like, you know, one of the most dynamic characters right now on television in Negan. So anytime he's on screen, your eyes can't turn away.
He was great and the end of the trash people. So that's why I give this episode a pass, but I acknowledge that it was kind of boring up to that point. And also as I think Russell put it on Facebook, the Pulp Fiction style effect of the different titles of the characters.
Oh, that was so
didn't work at all.
So
didn't
cheesy,
work at all.
I thought. But
yeah, it could have worked if they had actually focused on different characters, but they didn't really. It was still involving all these other people that were in the, like, what's the point of having Rick and Michonne divided into different segments when they're both in the same segments together?
Who knows?
Anyway, so yeah, you know, not the best episode, but at least they're starting to jettison some of the dead weight from the show. Hopefully that will continue in the coming weeks.
And not in the form of Maggie, as the rumor currently is.
Oh, God, that would be horrible.
Yes.
That would be horrible. No, the next prominent deaths need to be, let me see, Oceanside.
Mm-hmm.
Who else would I like to
Father Gabriel.
Go? Father Gabriel.
Had many sons. Many sons had Father Gabriel.
Yeah. Is what's his name still around? Gregory? Is he still around?
Yes, he needs to die.
He needs to die. Mm-hmm. That long-haired savior, he needs to die.
That long-haired savior?
You know that long-haired savior that's locked up at the hilltop right now?
Now, is he a long-haired country boy?
Oh. But, you know, speaking of country boys, Nick, I hear that somebody's been messing with country boys.
Yeah, I saw a little bit going on a certain Facebook message thread, and, you know, I would watch myself. You know, I know you folks out there in California think you're safe from the wrath of what might happen if you go messing with a country boy, but I would not recommend it, quite frankly.
Yeah, I wouldn't mess around with a country boy. I mean, listen, you may be able to survive the mean streets of Sacramento, mm-hmm. hypothetically, if you were to make such a comment.
Yeah, but.
But you would not be able to survive the mean streets of mudlit Kentucky.
That's right. And you got to remember, you're about to make a trip down south. You don't want to be. Listen, I just wouldn't press my luck, is all I'm saying.
Exactly. So, yeah, that long-haired savior, I don't know, he may have already died, but he's locked up in the pen. He needs to die. Okay, and then I would like to see all of Negan's lieutenants die slowly, and then Negan at the end of the season. As much as I love Negan, he's got to die. That's just how it is. If he wants to take Rick with him, all the better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to see Negan. I'm conflicted because I don't want to see Negan die because it would mean that Jeffrey Dean Morgan was no longer on the show. Right. But I also don't want to see him become redeemed, which is what they seem to be building right. towards.
I definitely don't want to see Negan and Rick picking vegetables next to one another.
God almighty. Carl's boring vision of the future.
I mean, even in this episode when Negan was talking to Rick and he's like, that's why I had to murder your friends, was to make you see how things can be. I was like, no, that's not an acceptable.
And what about Negan, like, you know, damn it, I had plans for that boy. He was going to be the future. What kind of plans did he have for Carl? Yeah. And what did Carl ever do to indicate that he was going to be the future of multiple groups of people?
Nick, what kind of plans did old Stu have for young
for young Carl?
Prospective wrestlers that
and take him down in the basement
Hart family
and,
dungeon.
And stretch him a little bit.
And stretch him, yeah. Rub a little bit of oil behind the ears there.
Stuff.
Greased up head, slip at it anywhere. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So, with all that being said, now we are finally done with reading and watching. And, you know, there's not much left to say in this episode, Nick. What do we have coming the people's way in the coming weeks?
Well, we're going to finish up this month. We have, of course, our landmark 100th episode next week as we are going to do a very special edition of Countdown where we've been accused of being DC fanboys in the past, which is probably true. So we're going to do probably one of the more difficult countdowns we've done where we are going to have to narrow down our five favorite DC comic stories of all time. That's DC comic stories in general from across the publishing pantheon. Tremendously hard to narrow it down to five. We're going to have to see how that goes. And then we're going to wrap up the month with a very special long book hunt on The Court of Owls, the landmark first volume from Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo's acclaimed New 52 Batman run. Before getting into the month of April, where we will be investigating Captain America Civil War and the latest installment of our Hard Travelers for Hire series. And I'm sure we have some other things on the docket, but can't remember exactly what they are now. And tentatively scheduled for the end of this month is a very, very special edition of Giant Size that will be the second volume of Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater.
And I have to say, folks, we've gotten the majority of the recording now for this special mm-hmm. in the can. And I have to say, in my in my opinion, my objective opinion, I feel like we elevated it to even greater heights this time than we did the first time.
Then the first time out, yeah, I would tend to agree with that. It is unique from beginning to end.
Before we go, I would like to invite everyone that is listening to this to please go to Place to Be Nation Pop. If you're interested, if you like this show at all, or even if you hate this show, honestly, go listen to some of the other shows on PTB and Pop. Sellers Points Podcast, Geek and Sassy, Sunday Groove.
Easy Like David Sunday.
Easy Like David Sunday, if you prefer, which is for music buffs out there.
Imaginary Stories Podcast.
Imaginary Stories Podcast. Conversation Comics with Todd Weber and Tim Capel. We've got a brand new podcast for people that maybe aren't into comics but want to hear about other pop culture stuff, Talking Pop with Jenny and Tim. Very good first episode. We've just got a litany, a veritable heaven of podcasts here on the feed. Please go check all of them out. And right now, I think I'm going to see a minute on the clock.
Oh, God, here we go.
It's time for the Wrestling Minute, and we're going to start that right now. So, Nick, the WrestleMania card is coming up. What do you make of it so far?
I don't really care about the WrestleMania card. What about the NXT TakeOver New Orleans card? Right now, Greg, on the card, you have, after tonight's the spoilers from this week's tapings, you have a triple threat tag title match between the Authors of Pain, Roderick Strong, and Pete Dunne, and the Undisputed Era. You also have the six-way North American NXT title match between EC3, Ricochet, Killian Dane, Lars Sullivan, and the Velveteen Dream. And then you have, of course, Andrade Cien Almas against Aleister Black for the NXT title and the rumored Johnny Gargano-Tommaso Ciampa unsanctioned match. I am more excited for that than I am for Mania at this point.
Oh, it looks incredible. It looks absolutely incredible. What a card. NXT always puts together a great card. I'm also looking forward to AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura if we get that match.
In theory, yes.
And also to see what else they have coming around. And also, Capone's been coming to town. What's going to happen when Capone gets here? What's Bogart got to say about it? Hear that? And all that's more on the Wrestling Minute. Woo! 1 minute.
Mm.
1 minute, Nick, of the greatest wrestling talk you ever did here.
Mm-hmm.
Right here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. That has been the Wrestling Minute. This has been the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Please tune in next week. We'll try to do better.
Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard traveling fanboys.